Steve, thanks very much. Hi, everybody. It's Bill and Wendy. It's Wednesday. We're thrilled that you're listening. Please call in or text in.
Oh, yeah.
We're rocking you into the night.
312-981-7200 if you'd like to do either of those things. You know who I'm worried about is Kevin, our producer, for two different reasons. I have two different reasons to be worried about Kevin. Number one, he's been sick for a long time.
You sound better today, though, Kev.
Well, I got sick, Sunday? So it's not been that long.
Somebody your age should be healthy. I'm concerned.
Okay, Gramps. Concerned.
And then the other reason is he was explaining to me before you got here that he is now hooked on The Bachelorette.
What is wrong with you? And you're getting married.
Correction here. Yeah. I'm not hooked. I told him I stopped watching. But I was watching, yes.
A lot. Like binge watching. There was dozens of episodes at a time.
There was a character that I hate watched. You know what I mean?
Yes.
He was
I do.
Testosterone
what
rage,
does that
this
mean?
Guy Chad.
It means somebody who just
hate them so much you can't stop watching?
Yeah, because you want to just groan and throw things at the TV and hate on them. You want to get your hate on.
Right.
His name was Chad, which I thought was everybody's name on The Bachelorette.
You might as well
every character
what
named
have
Chad?
We learned about guys named Chad?
Trouble.
Phil's words to live by, never trust a guy named Chad.
Well, that
trust me when I tell you, that's true.
I am trusting you to not trust them.
You can't trust people named Chad, with the possible exception of the late, great Chad Everett.
I don't think you could have trusted him either, quite honestly.
All right, I can see that.
There's always a little bit of Chad right. that you can't trust.
Right, right. The name implies untrustable Chad. That's what it means.
I'm now in
the country of Chad.
And I'm past that show now. Once he got voted off, there's no reason to watch anymore.
But before that, you were watching it regularly.
Oh yeah, he was great.
Is it worse than me watching Big Brother?
I think it is.
I don't think it is.
Can I tell you why it is?
Yeah, and I'll tell you why it isn't.
On Big Brother, you don't have one person making out with everybody else on the show.
Yeah, you do.
Do they do that
on
Big Brother?
Well, not with everyone else. Usually, there becomes a bromance. They call it like Big Brother. Bro.
Yeah.
Brother.
I get that.
Well, I know, because it's not two guys. It's usually a couple that hooks up, which if you're trying to win Big Brother, here's the thing. If you want a little on the side, first of all, there are cameras in the house all the time, so they're going to capture you doing it.
It's inescapable.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But don't let on to the others that you got a bromance going on, because then...
I don't think bromance means what you think it means. What does bromance mean?
I just said it's called Big Brother, so they're calling it...
They call it a bromance?
A showmance. I think they do call it a bromance. I don't know. I know what it means. Two guys oh, yes, I love this guy.
Bill and Grant Mulvey.
Exactly.
That would be a perfect example. But we're two guys that like to hang around together and do
lumberjack-style
things.
In your pajamas.
So, it's more comfortable that way.
You know how man's fantasy is like girls in very skimpy pajamas having pillow fights?
Yeah.
Every girl's fantasy for men is to do lumberjack things in boxer shorts.
That's right. Sometimes he'll call me up and he'll go, you want to go logging? And I'll go, yeah, let's go logging. And we do.
That's code.
That's not nice at all.
It is nice.
No, it's not.
Well, if it's not nice, it's a slam to Grant Mulvey.
It's just two guys who have fun having fun.
I think it's a showmance, okay? I think
showmance
that's what they call it.
Makes more sense. All right.
But so anyway, a couple will hook up, and then who's going to... If you're trying to win the game of Big Brother, you would vote one of them off because you want to split the relationship. So if you're going to have a little nookie going on, don't let on to the others in the house. That's all I'm saying. And that
are these people married when they're doing this?
No, most of them are single. There have been some married people, and they're not involved in a showmance.
Right. Okay.
So you say The Bachelorette is worse?
I think it's worse because the goal of that is... Just to...
Whoring around?
Yeah. That's what it should be called. That's what it should be called, is the whoring around hour. Because that's all you get.
Yeah, that's... You know what? I don't want to watch that.
I wouldn't want to... the whole thing is, of course, to be the one chosen by either The Bachelor or The Bachelorette. But once you realize that this girl has had private time with all the other competitors, don't you... all of a sudden, she could be the most beautiful woman in the world, but as soon as that happens, I'm out. I don't want any part of that.
Sloppy seconds or
eighths. Ninths,
tenths. Do you think no one ever rehearses?
Right. Throw that into the mix, and then you have a real problem. I'd want to spray her down with Lysol. That'd be my time with her. I'd just spray her with Lysol.
God, I would pay every ounce of money I have, which isn't
if
a lot.
I was on The Bachelor.
Yes, because you just, I would love to see, you know, Rico Suave, a.k.a. Bill Leff.
I would put those things, you know, if you ever use a public restroom and they have those sheets
the
that they put
shields.
On the toilets. Yeah, I would have a woman-shaped one of those and I would just put it all over her. And just completely cover her with that.
Like a press and seal figurine.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
That's what I would do. I don't want to catch anything.
Yeah, you'd be good on that show.
How soon into my interview would they kick me out?
Yeah, but people would watch just going, look at this guy. You'd become, Kevin would watch it again because he'd be the guy, you'd be the guy he hated. He'd hate watch just for you.
They'd make me, I'd have to change my name to Chad. They're all named Chad on that show.
Yeah, you're cute. I'll take a pass.
Right. Right.
Yes.
That would be it.
Thanks for coming by.
She would pick me. She'd hand me that rose and I'd go,
I'm good.
I don't think so. Thank you, though. Pick another Chad. I'm out. This Chad is out. I'd drop a microphone that I don't even have. I'd pretend to drop a microphone. What's wrong with that man?
See, this is why I wish I had all the money in the world just to pay you to audition and do this. Seriously.
Would I be more detestable than Chad, Kevin? Yeah, I would be.
Yes.
Yeah, he's nodding. Yep. Yes, I would be.
I'd still like to see it.
I can't believe that people keep watching that because that's all that goes on that show. That's it.
It's
that's
getting
all you get.
Ratings out the
yin
yang.
I know. It doesn't make any sense.
I have never watched an episode. I never watched The Bachelor either.
No.
And my cousin-in-law was on the first...
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Jamie Blythe. He's Jimmy Mack's cousin.
Yeah.
And he was on, I think, the first few seasons, maybe the first season of The Bachelor.
I think I had him on my Saturday show.
Yeah.
Once.
Oh, was
I think
he?
You did.
Do you know good whose look. Brother is on it right now?
Jamie Blythe's?
Nope. That's a great guess, but no.
Billy Deck?
No.
Alec Baldwin?
No.
That was a great guess because there are a lot of brothers.
That's a solid guess.
I mean, I actually know who it is, if you mean... I don't want to spoil
it. Can you give me a hint?
He is or a... He's a
wow. My Freudian slip
wow.
is showing.
It's 10:30 somewhere.
Wow. His brother is a star athlete. A very famous athlete.
Oh, I do
athlete.
Know who. Brian Urlacher's brother.
No. Casey Urlacher, no.
Who is it?
It's Aaron Rodgers' brother.
Oh, I did know that. Sorry,
you're just
I got
running stories
up.
Together. Brian Urlacher's brother's running for Congress or something like that.
Right.
Welcome to my brain. It's not fun to be in there.
And this is before anyone gave her a hit.
I know. Think of the fun after, Steve. All right, we need to take a break.
It's 10:30 somewhere.
And do drug exams, and then we'll come back and give you more show, Bill and Wendy WGN.
That's not lemonade. All right, we were talking, I don't even know why you're worried about Kevin because he watched The Bachelor and because he's sick. Any other reasons?
No, when I came in today, he looked like he was going to cry, and I said, Kevin, is everything all right? What's wrong? And he said, well, Chad is off The Bachelorette, and he looked so, so depressed and just beaten down. And I said, it's pretend. It's okay. There's no, I mean, semi-pretend.
It's not really pretend.
Well...
It is totally pretend.
It's
isn't
called
it?
Reality television.
Yeah,
Bill. It's
but
real. It's in the
but
name.
It's mislabeled because it's
all the reality shows are more fake than sitcoms.
That's so true. That is so true.
I mean, I'm worried about your wife, first of all, because she's been married to you for 25 years.
As of tomorrow.
I can't believe you made
there.
It.
How's the outfit coming?
The smart outfit. What was it?
Snappy. It's going to be a snazzy outfit. For my 25th anniversary. Thank you. It's coming along fine. Thanks. Went to Jay Riggins yesterday and picked out some very nice duds.
Oh, nice.
So I feel sorry for your wife because tomorrow's the big 25th anniversary. I cannot believe you have held on to her that long.
Well, we've been together 31 years, but married for 25. It took
you
six
keep
years
saying
to
that,
get
but
that
it really,
together.
You know, until you made a legal woman out of her, it doesn't count.
I guess. It took a while to afford the wedding. We paid for our own wedding.
So did we.
Because they didn't have crowdsource funding back when I was...
What a great idea that would have been.
I think people have done that, haven't they? I bet people have done that.
Why wouldn't you?
A GoFundMe page?
Honestly, we paid for our wedding too.
Yeah.
Why would you not try to do that?
I think it's a smart idea.
I can go on the GoFundMe page and find 25 things that I feel so horrible about or so happy about that I want to donate to. So I can't go on that page anymore.
I think if you put some sort of a story, whatever, I mean, we weren't poor, but we couldn't afford our wedding. You know, it took us years to be able to afford the wedding we
wanted.
That's
what you saved for? That's why it took so long? I don't believe you.
Well, we were saving for a wedding and then eventually a house. Yeah, yeah. But the wasn't there. Well,
why do it the correct way, Bill?
I know. But they didn't have options like they have now of going to the internet and telling your story and saying, if you want to see two people who are happy now but would be even happier once they're married, you know, donate $5, $10, $15, $20. But I've seen people do that.
I want to do a GoFundMe experiment.
Like what?
Fund Bill Left's toy collection. But just to see.
That would be selfish.
I know, but a lot of GoFundMe is selfish. A lot of it is based out of tragedy.
Yeah.
And I mean, really, if you go to that page right now, Bill, you're going to be heartbroken so many times, you'll be broke.
But I can't compete with that tragedy.
Yeah, but sometimes somebody wants to make someone happy.
Oh, yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Add to Bill's toy collection. It's starting to sound good, isn't it?
No, I would feel guilty taking anybody's money for that.
All right, well, here's why I'm worried about your wife, because you mentioned Kevin watches The Bachelorette.
Yes.
Doesn't your wife watch one of the Real Housewives show?
I think she watches all of them.
That is so not like Terry.
It's the exact opposite
I know.
Of her. It is. And
you're going to make it till tomorrow, 25 years?
Yeah, because I've come to accept, because she equates it with my love of sporting events. She goes, you'll just turn on a game, and I will. Like if the Pirates are playing the Nationals, and I don't, you know, why would I need to watch that? But if I turn it on and it's on, I'll watch an inning or two, and she'll go, it's the same version of that. You're watching sporting events where you don't...
They don't fight as much in the sporting events.
Not even boxing and wrestling.
I know.
It's not even close.
Maybe she should start watching boxing.
And I used to watch The Bachelorette. I don't watch it anymore, Bill. I'm above that.
Because of Chad's dismissal.
Well, yeah. Chad was everything.
Now, listen to this. This is just to show you... Go on, Steve. What were you
going
to say?
No, I don't want to anymore.
Just to show you the cultural impact of a show like The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, I don't watch it. I know next to nothing about it, but I do know that a week or so ago, Aaron Rodgers' brother who was on it, his name is Jordan Rodgers, he had a moment where they were asking him about what it's like to have a famous brother, a big star brother. That must be great. You know, you're probably palling around with one of the greatest football players of our generation. And it became kind of apparent that those two guys don't really get along. And that's sad. Isn't that sad?
Yeah,
I didn't see it, but I was reading about it, and I thought, well, that's too bad. I mean, he's kind of...
Well, he should learn how to fix that, because it's probably the reason he's on national TV.
I was thinking the same thing, Steve. I really was. I bet that has something to do with it.
That's kind of depressing, because you want to be able to brag about your brother and stuff,
right?
And he's not able to. What happened to them?
I didn't even know he had a brother until this guy popped up on television.
Let's get them back together.
Do you want to do that?
Yeah.
There's your GoFundMe page.
Some dude on GoFundMe or something like that collected $1,000 so he could make a potato salad for a family reunion.
And he made his goal?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I gave to that. We each get a little cup of salad. It was very good.
I'll make you one for less than that. You don't even have to pay me.
Is that
Bill
part
won't get
of,
any because he won't eat my food.
I won't. Just so you know. Is that part of it, though, is like whenever you set up a page like that, do you have to give back? Or do people just give the money and then that's the end of it?
Oh, that's
or do
the
you
end
say,
of it.
Oh, okay.
But you have to reach your goal. So if this guy wanted $1,000 to make a potato salad, which, God, how big was the potato salad?
And what was in there?
Gold.
Chunks of bouillon? Gold bouillon?
Yukon gold potatoes.
If you don't hit your goal... then you don't get the money.
The money's all refunded to the donors.
Right. So here's what you do. If you're on a GoFundMe account and you're not getting your money and say you're $1,000 short, if you have $1,000 in your savings account, just donate it yourself so then you hit your goal and you get all the money.
Oh.
I got it all figured out. I just don't have a purpose. I have no reason to use it.
That's the one little detail that's missing is the purpose.
Yeah, I got nothing.
Don't give up. Please don't give up.
I like to bead. I like to make necklaces. I would like to put out a GoFundMe page for $117 so I can get my beads to make a necklace.
But there has to be some, like if you put that, nobody would pay any attention to that because there's no sadness. There's no tragedy to that. Don't you need to have some kind of element where people go, oh, I feel awful for them. I'll give money because of that.
Usually it's when, you know, a family dies or a member of a family and they can't afford funeral expenses. But what about the guy with the potato salad?
Yeah, that's curious.
How did he get funded?
I don't know why he got any money. That doesn't make sense to me.
Good God.
Are there brackets on there? Like, are there some that are only sad stories and some that are
it's all
potato salad based?
The three bean salad goes down to the
Who
potato
eats
salad.
That?
I don't know.
Although I had bean salad the other day that was brought in, but there were more than three beans. You need more than three beans to call it a salad.
That should be the title of your biography.
Sounds like we're past 10:30.
All right, let's take a quick break. Dr. John Duffy will be joining us after 11 o'clock.
Is he still coming?
As of now, he says he's still coming, but we'll see. And then the author of Another Round, this is the second book about Wisconsin supper clubs, the sequel.
I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, isn't it beautiful?
All I can tell you is I have a hankering for prime rib, because that's big at supper clubs, and fried haddock.
Oh, yeah. That sounds delicious. All right, stick around. We'll talk fried haddock later. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. All right, don't forget, we have a full, packed show today. Dr. John Duffy will join us at 11:05. The author of not one but two books about Wisconsin supper clubs will be in studio with us at 11:35. And then later on in the second half of the show, a local pastor who wrote a piece about the night that late-night comedy died. There was a very specific event that he can pinpoint this to. So those are just some of the highlights of what's coming up on today's show.
I think I'll listen.
I'm going to listen. I'm definitely listening. It's news time right now. We're coming up on 10:30. This news report is sponsored by Cars for Kids. Here is Steve Bertrand. Steve, thanks very much. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder.
Bertrand's grooving. He's getting his funk on.
Can you blame him? I can't blame him.
I'm doing my Rick James.
I think you were right the first time.
Rick Astley.
He Rickrolled us.
Yeah. Yep. I know that you're not a Cubs fan. I know you put up with the fact that the city treats them like gold and doesn't give the White Sox their due. I appreciate that. But last night's game was one of the strangest things I've ever seen in baseball. Did you watch, Steve?
I watched a lot of it, yeah.
What happened?
Wow.
A 15-inning affair. The Cubs had the lead through most of the game. They gave up a run in the eighth. They gave up a run in the ninth. This, of course, means extra innings. But what happened in extra innings is something that I didn't think was possible. They kept bringing in guys, pitchers, because they were out of position players. And Joe Maddon kept switching off between the pitcher and the left fielder. Like, the pitcher would pitch for a guy, and then he'd bring in the left fielder, who was also a pitcher, Peralta. And then he'd switch him with Travis Wood. And then after the next batter, he'd switch him back and forth, depending on if the batter was a lefty or a righty.
It was like baseball stratego.
So I went to bed right the inning before, and you could see that you could see Maddon looked like he was telling Peralta in the dugout.
Yeah.
Right? Because they started, he told him, and Peralta had this look on his face that you just smacked him in the back of the head or something.
It was a look like, all right, if you tell me to do that, I will do that. But then it got weirder into the 14th and 15th innings. Spencer Patton, who's also a pitcher and had no background playing the field at all, except maybe in, you know, Little League or something like that. So then he's doing that with Travis Wood. Now, here's the question I'm going to ask, because I don't know the answer to this, and I've watched a lot of baseball. Spencer Patton got the win. He was the pitcher when the Cubs got the lead. They got five runs in the 15th inning. Could he then have also gotten the save if they continued to flip-flop he and another player? Like, I thought once you pitched and you weren't pitching anymore, I thought you were done.
Oh, interesting. Right. So if he was in the game when they got the lead and then came in later to preserve the lead.
Right. So let's say, like it did play out, he was the pitcher of record. The Cubs got the lead when he was the pitcher. But let's say Maddon continued to do what he was doing and switched off with Patton and Travis Wood or Pedro Strop, who we also brought in. They had four pitchers play left field for the Cubs during that game.
See, that's weird to me because I've never seen a pitcher play another position.
Neither of those pitchers.
Yeah, it was that rare. And then as a side question, here's another question that I was wondering the whole time I was watching this because it was so surrealistic. And guys on the Cubs, including one of the coaches, Davey Martinez, kept laughing. Like, they'd show him, and he's like, I don't even know if this is baseball anymore. I'm watching it, but I can't believe what I'm seeing. All throughout baseball, like the baseball I played anyway, and I just played Little League for a bunch of years, your weakest position on the field was always right field. If there was a kid who wasn't really good at catching the ball, you always put that kid in right field. Now, in professional baseball, where a guy can kind of hit it almost not almost anywhere he wants, but he's got, if you're a right-handed batter, you're usually going to hit to left field.
Right.
Why put the most suspect fielder in left field? Why not in right field?
It's a shorter throw. Is it right?
Yes.
It is a slightly shorter throw. Yeah. Yeah.
That is a great question. And is it plate right or field right?
It's
like when you're at the plate looking out, right field is to your right.
When correct. You're batting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because left field would be the one a right-hander would hit to most frequently. That is an excellent question.
Does it happen often? Just because of the lineup, though, Bill? I mean, they would have better left-handed hitters?
No, because most of the guys batting last night in those extra innings, not all, but most of them were right-handed batters. So if all went according to plan, they'd be hitting it out to left field. But you had four different pitchers for the Cubs playing left field, and they didn't get a ball all night.
That's
nothing
weird.
Was hit out there. It was like left field was closed, like we used to play.
Yeah,
in
if you were short a player.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Doug DeCenzo, did he get in at bat?
No, Doug DeCenzo was not in the game last night. Now, he's an outfielder, for people who don't know who that is. He was an outfielder who they used to bring in and pitch if the Cubs were losing by 20 or more runs,
right.
Which used to happen a lot.
Yeah.
They'd go to Doug DeCenzo. And he
now, no, it's 18.
Why would they bring him in just so he could get some practice?
He liked to pitch, and he had pitched in high school or college.
Waste another pitcher.
Yeah. That happens. That happens way, way, way more frequently where there's a position player that they'll let pitch for an inning. That happens a bit. But I've never seen one pitcher, well, I shouldn't say never. I have seen it once or twice. But never four guys. They had four different pitchers playing the outfield for the Cubs at some point yesterday.
That is bizarre.
Insane.
And they won.
They did
with a grand slam.
Yeah. They did win.
This is their storybook year, maybe. I know everybody thought last year was, but...
Well, Joe Madden, who I really do believe is the best manager in baseball, because he was thinking ahead in both of these instances. The inning before, he's like going, "Oh, what can I do to preserve my bench?" Because at some point, you just run out of guys. You're allowed 25 guys, and that's it. And you don't. There's a couple guys you don't want to put out there. You know, Jake Arrieta. You don't want to risk that.
Yeah.
Don't put him out in the outfield. So he really was limited in his options, but. Like a good chess player, he figured out several moves in advance the best way to maximize his team. And I've seen him do that a couple of times where you just go, what are you doing? And then it works. And actually, that's what they said at the very end of the game. I was watching, I go, it worked. And then they said that on TV a half second later. It worked.
That's pretty amazing. Joe Madden, I don't know anything about until he came here. I mean, I'm not a baseball fan in that respect. And everyone I talk to, even Sox fans, are like, this guy's amazing.
He is. He's not like the prototypical. You know, when we were growing up, there was a manager that was kind of humorless and way too much business. And we're not here for fun. We're only here to win.
Yeah.
He somehow is able to pull both off at the same time.
You never see, you know, I know what you're saying about the really stern manager, right? But even the happy-go-lucky ones, you never see them laughing in the dugout,
no.
The way you see Joe Madden.
Right.
Well, it's all attitude.
Right.
I think that just whether it's a corporation or whatever.
But when you make a job fun, you get better performance from your employees.
Oh,
look at
definitely.
Here at WGN.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking, yeah.
I mean, seriously, when it's fun to come to work every day, you're going to want to come to work and you're going to want to try your best. If you're miserable and get reprimanded for everything, you're not going to put out your best.
He does this thing. Joe Madden does this thing with the Cubs on travel days where he picks a style of outfit, often outlandish, and then the players all have to abide by that and dress that way. And you think, well, they're not going to do that. If the Cubs are in a little bit of a slump, Madden's not going to do that now. The team is losing. Don't mess with their heads. But then he still does it.
It's fun. Suit day, Hawaiian shirt day.
No.
I mean, that just really brings the morale of the team together where all of a sudden it's like, it's fun.
Yeah.
And baseball's supposed to be fun.
Those shirts that you see, you asked me about them a couple of weeks ago. They have the phrase, try not to suck on them. That is a quote from Joe Madden.
Love it.
I think to Javi Baez.
Try not to suck.
Right.
I love that T-shirt, and I thought they were Harry Carey's glasses.
No, they're
they
mad.
Weren't quite big enough.
Yeah.
But, I mean, once you get the iconic Harry Carey glasses thing, that's what you think right away.
Sure.
I know Madden also has glasses, and they were pretty close, but I, you know, not being a Cubs fan.
Yeah.
I was.
You didn't know the history.
But I loved that shirt, Try Not to Suck.
that's
a great motto for everyone.
I know. It's universal.
We'll really try not to suck today.
We'll try. Can't promise anything. All right, a quick break and then a lot more show. If you'd like to jump in, we'd love to hear from you. We're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that heartbreak hotel.
I love when he talks like this.
There was a lot of quiver in his voice.
I loved it. Quiver in his hips, too.
Quiver in his hips.
All right, leave it up there a little because I want to hear the guitar. Elvis Presley, force of nature in the world of music, but without his trusty backing musicians, he wouldn't have made the impact he did. And Scotty Moore, Elvis Presley's guitarist, has died at the age of 84. No cause of death is known at the moment, but he'd been in poor health for a few months prior to his passing. Early 50s, he moved to Memphis, Scotty Moore did, started a band, and then he and his band partner at the time were chosen by Elvis to play on this song, Heartbreak Hotel, That's All Right Mama, Hound Dog, Blue Suede Shoes, Jailhouse Rock, and Scotty Moore was one of the 100 greatest guitarists of all time by Rolling Stone, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2000, and this is the interesting thing, without Scotty Moore, we may not have had the Rolling Stones.
How does that happen?
Keith Richards was the one speaking when Scotty Moore was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and Keith Richards said, when I heard Heartbreak Hotel, here's the guitar right here, I knew what I wanted to do in life. It was as plain, I should sound like Keith Richards, but I can't.
We wouldn't understand it anyway.
When I heard Heartbreak Hotel, I knew what I wanted to do in life. It was as plain as day. All I wanted to do in the world was to be able to play and sound like that. Everyone else wanted to be Elvis. I wanted to be Scotty.
Wow, that says a lot, doesn't it?
So, Scotty Moore, dead at the age 84.
It's hard to believe Elvis and his contemporaries, his cronies, would be in their 80s or anywhere near that. Because Elvis in my head is like 38 or 39 years old.
What, you're forgetting the Vegas Elvis?
Well, Vegas Elvis is older.
Right.
There's
but,
more than one Elvis.
But we think Elvis, you don't think to the white jumpsuit Elvis. The cape and all that.
Actually,
and
that's probably, if I had to break it down, that's probably the most entertaining Elvis, isn't it?
Because
that's when it was cartoon Elvis.
I didn't want my I didn't want my Elvis
you
cartoon-like.
You wanted more pure Elvis.
Yeah, because it's funny, you know, you get the little picture in your head when you're imagining something. When I think Elvis, I think, you know, all shook up. Oh.
Right.
I think of
right.
the young whippersnapper
yeah.
Elvis.
I liked him after he found ho-hos and ding-dongs. I like that. I like the bulkier, jumpsuity Las Vegas Elvis.
Yeah, because you like to make fun of him.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna count that out.
Did you see that his daughter, Lisa Marie
yes.
Presley, has now divorced for the fourth time?
All right, here's what shocked me. First of all, when you see this on the internet, you realize how she looks exactly like him. Same with the, same sneer. Uh-huh.
Never a smile, always a sneer from Lisa Marie.
What astounded me is that she had been married four times, because
yeah.
she's young.
And this latest marriage was to the Mad Hatter. Did you see that? This guy's wearing a giant hat.
Oh, yeah. I remember when she married him. I'm like, what are you thinking?
Don't marry the Mad Hatter.
it did look like
Set Alice in the
Tom,
March Hare and
Tom
the Queen
Petty
of Hearts.
Got jealous for that Don't Come Around Here No More video.
Yeah, I know. This man wore a big
the
hat.
Mad Hatter.
When they would fight, he would hide in his hat. Where are you going? Come back here. She'd sneer at him, and he'd just hide in the hat.
I couldn't believe she had been married four times. And then, so upon reading about it, I forgot she was married to Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson and Nicolas Cage. Not at the same time, although would it be much weirder? But think about, I always talk about how people have a scope of, like, what is your range? What is your, because to me, the strangest one is always Mia Farrow, who is married to both Frank Sinatra and Woody Allen. That's weird.
Oh, the mate spectrum?
Yeah, the mate spectrum.
Yeah, because it's from one side end to the other.
Right. But Lisa Marie Presley's mate spectrum goes from Nicolas Cage to Michael Jackson. That's impossible.
It's so weird, and because we had a chance to talked to Lisa Marie, and we put in a request, and I guess she declined. But
she had heard the show, obviously.
But I mean, I would imagine they consummated their relationship, don't you think?
No.
Nicolas Cage, definitely.
Nicolas Cage, yes. And Michael Jackson, I'm not positive that happened.
Oh, come on.
I'm not sure.
They were married.
But they shared the most awkward kiss in Kiss history on television. You saw how awkward that was. Can you imagine anything more than that? I can't.
Well,
I don't want to.
He just was afraid his nose would fall off. Come on, be careful. I don't do a Michael Jackson. I know everybody else
Neither
does.
Neither did Lisa Marie.
What I find astounding, too, is they mentioned she's been married four times, and I don't know why I know this because I'm like a rock trivia freak. Mm-hmm. Danny Keough was not mentioned, and he's the one who I thought fathered her first child.
Her daughter, Riley, who is an actress and a model, and is... She's like, she also has Elvis's face, but somebody taught her to smile. She knows how to smile. Lisa Marie, not so lucky. But Danny Keough is the father of Riley Keough.
And they didn't mention him in this.
It was like
the Mad Hatter.
Yeah.
And it was Michael Jackson and Nicolas Cage. And she has 7-year-old twins with this current Mad Hatter guy.
Oh, does she really?
Yeah. So Elvis has 3 grandchildren. And what's happened to Priscilla? Good God, y'all.
Yeah, I know.
Whole lot of something going on.
You mean the plastic surgery.
Holy moly. I got to be careful or I'm going to start swearing. But yeah, she doesn't even... I mean, I fall for this clickbait where it's like celebrities who look completely different after plastic surgery. Don't you look in the mirror and say, I look pretty good. Is it like a tattoo? Do you get one and you want to keep going?
She's almost unrecognizable. Like, I only knew it was her because it said that it was her.
Right.
It says, this is Priscilla Presley.
You wouldn't have guessed that.
My guess was going to be Eric Severide. Do you know who that is, the news guy? That's who I thought it was. She looks awful. Doesn't look anything like herself.
She looks better than Eric Severide.
Slightly better. Just slightly better.
He's a handsome man.
He's a very handsome man.
But he's a man.
I know. But you can't tell that it's Priscilla Presley. There's nothing when you see her that reminds you of the old Priscilla Presley. Zero. There's nothing the same.
Well, moving on from the Elvis hunk to plastic surgery, I told you this off the air, and I know, obviously, Joan Rivers got some plastic surgery.
You don't know that.
Oh, I know for a fact. I'm not even saying allegedly.
No, she joked about it
I know.
The time.
And God bless her. I'm just so... I really... Her death is a terrible tragedy. Seriously.
Yeah.
We lost her way too soon.
Yeah.
But what is with Melissa? She all of a sudden...
She's following the same path.
Yeah, but why? She was so pretty in her own right. And there's an old picture of Joan Rivers, like when she used to be on The Tonight Show and stuff. Honestly, kind of pretty. As she got older, she looked a little duck-like. She had a very... Well, she did. She had a very thin chin.
Duck-like?
She looked like a little bit of a duck to me.
Right.
But a very cute duck.
She looks like a duck.
Right.
Why not a chicken? But so I could see, like, her first plastic surgery. I'm like, wow, Joan Rivers really looks amazing. But then she kept going, and then... It just got weirder, and Melissa's right on that same route. I mean, I don't understand how that happens.
If you're her daughter, you would have watched your mom go through everything she went through with the plastic surgery and said, I don't think I want to do that exact same thing.
And that's how she died, pretty much, isn't it?
It was connected.
Yeah. I just don't get it. Go ahead, get your Botox, get a facelift. I don't care. I'll do it someday.
You keep saying that. You're serious about this. You're going to have Botox.
I've had Botox before. It's just...
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
I'm
too lazy to make an appointment, and it's kind of expensive.
Yeah.
And you have to keep doing it until you finally paralyze the nerve of these little 11 lines in between your eyebrows.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any problem with that, but I'm scared that I'm going to keep going and look like a cat.
Right.
I'm going to look like Carrot Top by the end of the year if I start.
Steve Dale's going to actually sponsor this so that you can look more cat-like.
Noted cat and Botox expert.
All right, let's take a break. We have a lot more show coming. Dr. John Duffy after Steve's news. It's Bill Wendy on WGN. Dr. John Duffy joins us, as he does from time to time, clinical psychologist, best-selling author. His book, The Available Parent, are available wherever better books are sold. John, we could have used you yesterday. There was a discussion on the show. There was a woman who wrote a book about how best to deal with your child if they have weight issues, if they're underweight or overweight.
Right.
And is there or is there not a proper way to address that? And we had some callers call in and some texters text in. I said in a lot of cases, I believe, especially with a younger kid, that if the child has some sort of weight issues, you almost have to blame the parent. And then we had a listener call up very upset saying, I'm tired of taking the blame. I don't want to take the blame. Her child was 21 at this point, which
different
is
story.
A lot
different
older
story,
than I
right?
was talking
okay.
about.
Yep, yep.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I think with younger kids, you know, the idea is you want to teach them good habits, right? So you want them out and about as much as they can be out and about, running around and, you know, kind of like a lot of us lived when we were younger, and eating really healthy foods. A lot of us expect our kids to kind of rise to the occasion of being really healthy when we have a bunch of junk in, you know, in the cupboards. And so I think we have to model that for them too, right? You mm-hmm. know, and I talk about modeling in here a lot, but it's really critically important. If you're sitting on a couch as a parent and you're eating chips and watching TV and you're like, get out of the house and start eating some salads to your kids, it's probably not going to happen.
Right.
They're going to follow what you do instead of what you say. So modeling's a big part of it, and just encouraging him, like, you know, get out of the house and without even blaming anybody, just, you know, from where we are now, do a hard reset. Hey, I expect you to be out of the house for a few hours a day, out there having fun with your friends.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe you can do, we'll do one junk food meal a week, and then the rest of the time I expect you to eat well.
And, I mean, I said instead of, like, necessarily blaming the parent, if the parents are or kids are still living at home, the parent can just not say anything but start preparing healthier meals.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know
it
I mean?
Can be seamless, right?
Because, you know, growing up as battling weight on and off my whole life, you know, my mom, I was telling Bill off the air, my mom used to tell me, you know how when you're eating something, you bite the side of your cheek?
Yeah.
It happens to everyone. My mom's like, oh, that only happens when you put on a little weight.
Oh, no.
So that doesn't work,
that's
you know? It's
right.
like, you know, when you're fat, you know you're fat. If
right,
somebody
right, right.
says something, you kind of, like, get mad, and then you'll go eat.
Yeah, I think it gets down to the shaming thing, right? You want to eliminate
yeah.
shaming, right? And you want to be as constructive as you can moving forward, right? You don't talk about the past. You talk about, like, okay, let's establish new habits going forward. And to your point, Wendy, sometimes you don't even have to say it. Sometimes you just, like, start buying different food. And you might get a little attitude like, hey, where are the chips? Yeah, we're not buying chips this summer, you know? And then you just kind of move on from that. And you might
right.
get a little bit of attitude. But we all get a little bit of attitude. Not the end of the world.
When I was growing up, John, we had a bathroom scale. There was a scale in our bathroom, and you'd weigh yourself every day or every other day.
Right.
And when we bought our house, we had a bathroom scale. And then as my daughters got into, I guess, middle school, maybe fifth, sixth, seventh grade, the scale was gone. And I said to my wife, where'd the scale go? And she goes, you don't have a scale in the bathroom with teenage daughters. Or at that point, they weren't even teenagers yet. But she said, that's the worst thing in the world for a girl to look at a scale
even
every
for
day.
A boy, Bill. It's not just girls. Boys have weight issues now, too.
Oh, I definitely know that. But it never would, like, I needed somebody to explain that to me because
yep, yep.
I didn't know that.
I think a lot of us don't know that. And yet it is really, really important because kids, boys and girls, earlier than boys, I think, focus on that number, right? And will gauge their self-worth based on that number. I was talking to a girl this week who's a teenager who was gauging her self-worth on how she looked in a bathing suit that she admitted and her mother said very clearly was ill-fitting, like didn't suit her. And
yeah.
yet she was talking about this like, ooh, I can pinch this little tiny bit on my side. And if she had a scale in her bathroom, she would be devastated. It would, yeah, absolutely devastated. And there is no metric that would feel okay to her. That's the scary, slippery slope of it all, is it's not like, you know, if there were 3 pounds less or 5 pounds less, I would feel better. Oftentimes, once you lose the five, you think, well, if I lost 10 more, I'd feel even better than that. And
right.
then you get into a problem.
And you can take five people, male and female, line them up in a police lineup. They can all weigh the same, but they look completely different.
Absolutely.
So you can't base everything on weight.
Right. No, you can't. And a lot of it has, because their muscles heavier than fat and things like that. But for parents, I think the point ought to be, have something to do with more than just wait, more like self-acceptance, like, yeah. you know, like broadly speaking, you know, do you like yourself? Do you like the way your body looks? Is there something you can do about it? Can you get some exercise? Can you do something different so that you feel incrementally better? Not that you have to look like a model from a magazine.
Right. That's
but
impossible.
Something that makes you feel right. It's totally impossible. That's part of the problem. We all know that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. The author of this book, and I wish I could remember the title. I'm sorry I don't remember the title, but she said that one of the last things you ever want to do is say,
I'm like so fat or
that's
something.
It. I'm like so fat. Is it? Was wow. the name of the title.
Which, I don't like the title, but she's...
But she said one of the worst things you could do is say, look at your sister. Why can your sister do this and you can't in terms of weight?
Worst thing
but
ever.
I would imagine with other things too.
With just about anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. The comparisons between siblings, because everyone's got their own set of strengths, right? And challenges, and to make those comparisons, especially about weight, devastating. I mean, self-esteem crushing, and it's not going to do anything to change the weight. In fact, to Wendy's point and to your point, an overweight child might be inclined, because they're maybe comfort eating, to eat more, not less, to make that problem more prominent for themselves.
And is the food usually a masking of some other problem, usually, or
almost
is that not
always?
The case?
Is it? Yeah, right. I mean, one thing we learned in my profession really early on is it's rarely food. It's never food. You know what I mean? Almost always it's about something else, but it manifests in this kind of comfort eating.
Yeah. Isn't that why smoking happens and drug use and alcohol use? And the difference with the food is, if you quit drinking or smoking or doing drugs, you don't ever have to do it again. With food, you have to eat every day.
Exactly. Food is the one thing. Like, you know, you could add internet behavior and, you know, and porn use and a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah,
but
I got to work on my porn use.
That's what I'm getting at.
Just during work hours, Wendy. When you're home,
well,
it's your own free time.
I don't
time,
want my
but...
kids to check my history.
Right.
I don't care if my bosses do.
I think that's better.
Susan has a question or comment. This is Dr. John Duffy, and your website is, John?
DrJohnDuffy.com.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Wendy and Bill. Love your show.
Thank you.
Dr. Duffy, I have a question. I have a daughter, 16, been struggling with depression her entire life. Been in and out, you know, in therapy, actually, most of her life, on meds. She's currently in a program for CBT, and she is just... We're not getting anywhere.
Right.
My husband does not participate. He doesn't understand. And he does make comments that kind of make things worse and makes comments about her eating, you know, oh, my God, you're going to eat that. And she's thin and she's beautiful, but inside.
Can I jump in for one second?
Bad.
And I may be off base here, but in my own opinion, in experiences in my family and friends, is it a pride thing for men where they're sometimes hard to comprehend, like, oh, just suck it up and man up, or they're hard to believe that there's an underlying issue sometimes? Is that a true
I think
statement?
It's a fair statement. I think we men and fathers are slower on the uptake. I think oftentimes we take it personally when our kids are struggling, and so there's this little bit of like, oh, come on, just be less depressed. You have a beautiful life that we provided you, and just shake it off. And I don't know if that's what you're dealing with specifically, Susan, but, you know, program-wise, it sounds like you're doing everything right, like everything I can think of that I would suggest that you do in terms of, you know, CBT and getting a medication evaluation. It sounds like you've done all of those things. Your daughter's been in therapy for a long time, so... If your husband's the factor, the most important thing might be to get him into the therapy room, probably alone, before he's in there with you and with your daughter, so that he can work through his feelings about this a little bit. Because if he is resistant to it, there is no way that your savvy 16-year-old daughter is going to miss the point of that.
Well, she knows it. And he's
sure.
been in therapy for, you know, a few times here and there. And he, if, you know... Wendy, I know you've talked about this quite a bit, and I appreciate that. And I think it's great that you open up on air, but he's not willing to go there. I mean, like, you know, he'll physically go there, but he's not willing to open up about anything that he has an issue with himself.
Right.
So
it's, and it's not just men. There are some women that will not do it either. And how you can't force someone into going to therapy, John. How do you...
You can't. The trick, and I hate to use that word, but I kind of mean it. The trick, Susan, might be to talk to him about not what he needs to do better and what he's doing wrong, but more how do we as parents best serve our daughter, right? You know, like, so she's struggling and we're on different pages. So maybe you and I need to get and sit in front of somebody and get on the same page so that we are supporting her in the same way. Because if she's getting any mixed messages, it's probably prolonging this depressive issue for her. That might be the pitch that gets movement in your family where you feel stuck.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Good luck to you, Susan. It's tough, and you're a great mom.
Thanks, Wendy. Thanks, Dr. Duffy. And you too, Bill.
Oh, thanks,
you make
Susan.
Me laugh as well.
I appreciate it. Good luck with all this, Susan. We're pulling for you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
We'll take a quick break. More with Dr. John Duffy in just a little bit. If you have a question or a comment, easy to reach us at 312-981-7200. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
Dr. John Duffy in the studio with us, clinical psychologist, author of a great book called The Available Parent, certified life coach. You're really a run-of-the-mill guy, a man of many hats.
Well, thank you.
Someone has texted something in, and it's kind of interesting. That earlier caller, Susan, had mentioned that both parents weren't on board with the difficulties that their daughter was experiencing.
Right.
This is on the same line. My son was recently diagnosed with autism. My mother is in great denial of this. When she tells people that he has autism, she immediately follows it up with, "But I think they misdiagnosed him," and she won't stop doing it. I told her time and time again that she's not a doctor and that she needs to stop telling people that he is misdiagnosed, because he's not. I've given her literature, websites to go to. Nothing is helping me to get her to realize the truth. How do I help her understand that autism is not a life sentence these days? How do I help her understand that people can live a very fruitful and meaningful life with autism?
You know, I think the tricky thing to start is to acknowledge how she's feeling, how grandma's feeling, right? Because that child's life will probably be different than what grandma pictured, right? I mean, it might be markedly different, because autism is a spectrum disorder. And so it can go anywhere from mild to moderate to severe. And I don't know where this child is on that spectrum, but to acknowledge, like, I get that this is really, really hard for you to wrap your brain around. But to your point, Wendy, autism itself doesn't have to be a dirty word. Historically, it is. And we feel like, oh, boy, that is some kind of a life sentence and there's nothing we can do about it. But right now, there are so many different treatments for different spots on the spectrum. And if she can get on board and recognize, okay, if I'm on board, then we can start to work toward managing it and managing it well. I should point out, I've worked with a number of autistic children, and you know, shame on me. I can think of one young man I worked with. I started working with him about 5 years ago, and I thought, ooh, he's really going to be limited in what he can do. And he is this close to graduating from high school.
Oh, great.
Socially, he has come around to the point where it's almost imperceptible. And 5 years ago, it looked like he was really, really bad off socially. So I want to give your texter hope that this will change, and to give that grandmother hope that this can all change. But the faster she gets on board and recognizes, okay, this is a legitimate diagnosis, but let's work within it, then they'll get somewhere with it.
And there's a bunch of celebrities. Was it Dan Aykroyd that just came out saying that he's somewhere in the autism spectrum? Director Tim Burton, Daryl Hannah, Courtney Love. I mean, all these people, it's like now we know what it is. And in fairness to grandparents, it wasn't around then.
Nope.
I mean, I guess it was around then, but we didn't know what it was. So grandparents sometimes say, you know, oh, they're just boys will be boys. There's no issue going on, because it wasn't going on that we were aware of back when they were parents.
It's true. And there's so much more information, maybe too much these days, but there's a lot more information about all of these disorders. And so I think a lot of parents feel like, ooh, our kids are getting flooded with all these diagnoses and what's legitimate and what's not. And I can imagine a grandparent thinking, there might just be an element of social awkwardness there that he's going to grow out of. I can certainly imagine thinking that. But if they're a professional saying this is a legitimate diagnosis, then I think you have to defer to those professionals and work within that diagnosis.
Do you remember, John Travolta and Kelly Preston's son, Jet, was autistic, but they would never say that until after he died.
You're right.
And then they would talk about his autism, but while he was alive, and I don't know if that was just them convincing themselves that he wasn't autistic, or they just thought it was better to not refer
right.
to
shield him,
that.
From ridicule,
wonder,
from others, maybe.
Right,
yeah,
right, right.
I don't know.
I do feel like with autism or any disorder of any kind, I think the more open we are to talking about it, the less taboo
Amen.
There is around it, right? I mean, no matter what it is, whether it's ADHD, whether it's depression, whether it's anxiety, or whether it's autism, the more we talk about it, the less taboo it is, and the more it's kind of like we can kind of collectively work toward it. And then it's easier to get schools on board to help out with it, and educators and administrators and people in neighborhoods, you know, to recognize, oh, okay, this is what we're dealing with. What can we do to help, you
right.
know? But if we're clandestine about it, then I think we create shame
yeah.
in the child who's suffering something they can't do anything about.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes both my kids have ADHD, and in varying degrees. It's not like just a blanket statement, ADHD. Different kids are affected differently. And I remember when they first started school, Jim and I were scared to tell the school about it. Because it's like, we don't want this to be on their record. But then we realized we can get some extra help in various areas of school, and it's changed our lives because we have brought it up. And it's not that uncommon. My kids aren't the only kids going into the nurse's office at noon to take a pill.
Oh, man, are they not, right? I mean, like, right, the nurse's office is flooded at noon with kids
Absolutely.
Who need to take a pill for one thing or another. And so I think that you're right. I think you're handling it really, really well by being open about it. And I think the more we do that, and most disorders, you know, we talk about autism and Asperger's as spectrum disorders. But if you think about ADHD and you talk about your boys, that's a spectrum issue as well, right? Not mm-hmm. everybody suffers any disorder the same way. And that might give this grandmother a little comfort, too, is that it doesn't make her grandson any less unique or
right.
any less an individual or any less who he is just because he carries this diagnosis. And there are things we can do about it once we get behind it.
Excellent advice, as per usual. Check out Dr. John Duffy's podcast at WGNplus.com. Also on your website, drjohnduffy.com. Very fascinating. The young adults that you counsel and their openness to talk about their issues is an eye-opener.
I agree. I take very little credit for it. I'm blown away by how open they are, how much they want to help people who are
That's
listening.
That's what it is. They do want to help other people's. And even if it's not something you're dealing with, one of the topics may be, and it gets you thinking. And boy, kids are smart today.
Man, are kids smart. Right. Yeah. So I think I'm going to bring the wisdom. Hardly ever.
John, thank you. If you want to see or hear the podcast, you could look at them, but you won't see anything. You want to hear them. That's the best way to hear a podcast. WGN Plus is your source. Thank you, John. We appreciate it. That's Dr. John Duffy. We'll take a quick break and then more show after Ryan's news. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Ryan, thanks. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder, joined in studio by Ron Faola. He has written not one but two books about Wisconsin supper clubs. The latest is called Wisconsin Supper Clubs, Another Round. Ron, nice to see you. How are you?
Good to see you, Bill.
Appreciate you being here. Ron, Wendy has an ugly confession.
Well, first of all, I want to say Bill is completely obsessed with supper clubs. Completely
True.
Obsessed. I don't think I've ever been to one.
Wow.
Are you going to leave? You're going to walk out,
no,
aren't you? I wouldn't be surprised
not
if you left.
Not because I didn't want to go to one. I think the closest I came, I love relish trays, and you had asked me off the air, where in the world did you get a relish tray if you didn't go to a supper club? White Fence Farm, the restaurant. So I went to a supper farm.
Does that count?
That's not a supper club, I guess.
I don't know. If it was supper, why not? You know, it could be on a farm.
Well, define it for people who don't know what exactly this refers to. What is a supper club?
Well, in Wisconsin, you know, we have these supper clubs, and it says supper club out on the sign, and they're only open starting at about 4.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the bar opens at 4, dinner at 5. And
do they close early?
They do now. They used to stay open pretty late in the day when people were doing a lot more drinking. And but
people are doing less drinking now?
Yeah, we have stricter drunk driving rules, so that's kind
Yay
of hurt the bar
to
business.
That.
So, mm-hmm. But so a lot of guys are saying, you know, back in the old days it would be 1 o'clock in the morning, but now we're turning our fryers off at 8:30.
That's early.
Yeah.
But Ron, the name, just having the word club in there infers that you're part of something. You're in a club, but you don't have to belong. You just show up.
Right. There's people that actually walk in and say, you know, what's the membership cost? And, but yeah, you don't have to be a member. You can just walk in and enjoy the atmosphere. And the supper club term comes from New York during Prohibition,
mm-hmm.
when the speakeasies that were actually serving food and having floor shows, and it would be a place to go for the night and dress up. They were supper clubs. And so that term kind of came out both in movies and on radio. Chesterfield Cigarettes had a supper club show.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, yeah.
Plus, when it says club, you feel everybody wants to be part of a
club.
You're
a member of something.
Yeah.
It feels good. So. For some reason, and I don't understand why, and I like that this is the way it plays out, they're trapped in time. Like when you go in there, you feel like it's the 1940s or the 1950s, right. And they don't do anything to change that. They want you to feel that
they
way.
Probably they probably haven't cleaned since the 40s or 50s. Like those booths, please.
Yeah, you might find some old wheat pennies in there.
Right, but, right.
Yeah, you know, they have been around for a long time. They, you know, I've seen clean ones. I mean,
I'm totally teasing.
Yeah.
But the
signage
atmosphere
looks
dark.
Like it's the 1940s
aren't they
and
50s. Dark?
No, not necessarily. Are
they
some
can't.
Of them
the,
are.
My, the holy trinity of the decorations for supper clubs are three dark wood paneling,
yep.
which is
mm-hmm.
Taxidermy and twinkly lights.
Right.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So any combination of the three, you know, works, but usually all three is different.
There's always a fish mounted somewhere.
That's taxidermy.
Sometimes there will be like a squirrel head or something. And
get
that's,
out.
You know,
there's actually
sometimes.
In the new book, did you see the armed chipmunks?
Yeah, I did. Yes, I did.
Why? Is it just Wisconsin? I mean, I'm born and bred in Brookfield, Illinois, and I think Harvey's Prime Rib Inn in Countryside used to have a relish tray as well, and it was dark, and I don't know if there was taxidermy. But are there any supper clubs in Illinois, or is it all up north?
Yeah. Well, there a new one just opened up called Millie's, and they do the classic Wisconsin look inside and the classic supper club menu, and they're on Lincoln Avenue, I think, and... Mm-hmm. I used to go there when it was Lounge Acts.
Oh, I did too.
Yeah,
so that's where Millie's is.
Yeah, so I've had a few hangovers. but yeah, you know, there are I'm sure there are places that were very much like a Wisconsin supper club here in Illinois back in the 50s and 60s, you know, because a lot of places were only open for supper. And it was a place to go for some drinks, maybe some music, you know,
mm-hmm.
Just a night out. And so a lot, and the food would be prime rib and
yep.
lobster or steaks and, you know, stuff you don't normally make at home too much. So
I want to mention a couple in particular that were both in your first book. We'll get to the ones in the new book
okay.
in a second. But Ishnala is one that I went to when I was 5 or 6 years old and remembered it for years and years and years. And then I had you on with me on the night show. And Ishnala was featured on the cover of that book.
And they're now a sponsor of this fine
radio
station.
They're
now a sponsor.
Yeah, yes. They're now a sponsor. But I said to my wife, because you coming was like, it was some sort of a message sent to me that I must go back to Ishnala, which is located in the Wisconsin Dells on Mirror Lake.
Right.
And I said to Terry, we're going to drive up there. It's about a 5-hour drive. I have no idea. Maybe my dreams of it are one and it'll never pay off the way I remembered it. We went there. It was better than I remembered it. It was so incredibly good.
Yeah. Ishnala is the Sistine Chapel of supper clubs.
It is, isn't it?
I mean, you have this amazing view, the Arrowhead Bar, which, you know, overlooks the water as well.
Yeah.
And then the dining room that has, there's no bad seats in there. You know, everybody gets this look over the water.
Yep. It's stunning. The food is amazing.
Food
you
is
get
good.
Plenty of food, and
right.
it's just delicious. And then the other one, on Father's Day, my wife and I went with my daughters to Hobnob in Racine.
Right.
And that is, you walk into the 1940s when
yeah.
you walk in that room.
Yeah, and all the exotic wall hangings and vases and everything are from when the Higgins family owned it. One of the Higgins would travel around the world and buy up this stuff. They were closed in August for a month. And so he'd go out and get all this interesting stuff. So there's like the Lawrence of Arabia room that's mm-hmm. for two people and, you know, very exotic, very nice. So
is it really pricey or is it just far away from Chicago?
You know, it takes us an hour and 5 minutes to get there, which is not bad at all.
It's probably, I mean, for supper clubs, it's probably one of the higher ones, you know, compared to going up north and stuff. But you can't beat the view of the lake. And, you know, when I was there doing the first book, the moon came up, which was just amazing. And everybody's outside getting
You can
shots.
Have a drink outside. And they don't serve dinner out there because they said it's too windy to serve dinner out on the lake. But, you can have a cocktail out there if you like.
Right.
It's so beautiful.
Do they wrap your baked potato in foil?
They will, yeah. Yes, they will. You have
That's
to ask
old
nice.
School.
Yeah, very much. But here's the weird thing. What you said is true. The view of the lake is outstanding there at Hobnob, and yet more people eat inside at the dining room where you don't have a view of the lake, and I don't understand that at all. Why wouldn't you want to see the lake?
You can see it certainly from the bar, but then you sit down in the dining room, and that's pretty nice as well.
Yeah.
So. Those huge candlesticks and the paintings and everything. And
so ornate.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then more about supper clubs. If you have a question or a comment for Ron Fiala, just give us a call at 312-981-7200. Back after this, it's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
I named that band in one note, by the way, I'll have
Not
you
bad.
Know.
That's very impressive. Ron Fiala is our guest. He is the author of now a second book on Wisconsin supper clubs. This one is called Wisconsin Supper Clubs, Another Round. Ron, as is the case with the first book, the photography in this book, the writing's top-notch, but the photography is breathtaking.
Oh, thank you.
Really nice.
Yeah. You know, and people say, wow, the food looks amazing. And I say, well, that's a testament to the chefs out there because I'm not doing anything special to
dress it up.
Yeah, to
but you captured the look of all the like the bar areas and the restaurant areas. It looks like, and I said this to you, you don't know if these photographs were taken 3 weeks ago or 35 years ago. You can't tell.
Right. Well, you know, and that was one of the things that I wanted to do for both books really is not use a flash ever.
Yeah.
Because I was trying to capture the natural light.
Yeah.
So that bar shot that you were looking at the 5 o'clock in Milwaukee. That's like going back in time.
It really is. It really is.
There's a beautiful picture of a braised pork shank on a bed of garlic mashed potatoes, which looks pretty amazing at Helgeson's on 11 Harpo's Supper Club.
Yeah, that's in Janesville.
Is this like all like comfort food kind of?
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, who would really make that at home? So you kind of go out for a special night and enjoy that, and maybe some, you know, your spouse has some crab legs or something, mm-hmm. you know, and a cocktail or two, and, you know, an ice cream drink or something. And
Manhattans or Old Fashions or Brandy Alexanders or all of the above?
All the above, but mostly, you know, in Wisconsin, we're all about brandy, so it's got to be Brandy Old Fashioned.
A lot of them will have both a Brandy Alexander and a Brandy Ice. You can get either or both if you want. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Everything's in Brandy.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just bottles of Brandy right. are all over the place.
Don't they have the bubble drink that you like? What, the raspberry bubble?
The raspberry bubble is not out there. That's local
you
only.
You should bring it there.
I would be proud to bring it there. Creme de mint. You can get those in almost any supper club.
Sure. Yeah. 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 And like the Jacksonville Snifter is a good after-dinner drink, and it's something they make at the Jacksonville or Jackson Grill. They combine 5 liqueurs together in one bottle. That's a secret mixture, and boy, is it good after dinner. I mean, it's...
Wow.
That does sound really
good. Wow,
I've had a couple of those, and they're good.
I would think. And then on the menu, you're always going to see prime rib is almost always there. Shrimp de jong is almost always there.
No.
No,
now that's an interesting thing. Shrimp de jong, we only find, you know, it's a Chicago dish, but we only see it from up to Racine to Beloit, and that's it.
And that's all.
And I was up north. I was just in Waupac, and I said, how many people here have had shrimp de jong? And zero people.
Really?
Oh, and
I'm
they
very
didn't
surprised.
Know what it was.
And it's just a scampi with breadcrumbs on the top and bigger shrimp, so they use prawns, basically.
Yeah, but, it, you know, with the garlic and everything, and but people... I think scampi to me is just a little bit more, it's different, you know.
More buttery?
Maybe.
Not necessarily.
The sauce is more creamy sometimes.
Yeah.
And the Dijon is, you know, got the crumbs and everything. And,
yeah.
I don't know. It's just interesting that I go up north and I don't see it. So
I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah. Shrimp's not big up there?
I guess not.
No, they have shrimp cocktail.
Oh, they have tons of
They'll
shrimp.
They'll have stuffed shrimp or baked shrimp. Or
Okay, Bubba.
I'll name all 40 times. I'll name all 40. I can go all 40.
All right. People have comments about supper clubs that I don't know if you've been to, but they want to jump in on this. And actually, a good question here. Ron, I don't know if you're new to the supper club thing. I certainly am. You have a question about it?
Yeah, quick question. I'm not in front of a computer, and I've heard this term a lot, and I always mean to Google it. And I've heard the ads on the radio for Ishnala. What constitutes a supper club? In other words, what's the difference between that and, let's say, for example, here in Chicago, Gene and Giorgetti's? What constitutes a supper club? What's the difference between that and, let's say, the Gale Street Inn?
Well, I'm not familiar with those two Chicago restaurants, so I don't know. But supper club is family run. Everything's made from scratch. Family lives on the premises oftentimes. So
really?
Yeah. They're either upstairs or next door. So you're in their home. So they're going to treat you like you're a guest.
Well, that's the main difference, Ron. And the hours that we discussed a little bit earlier, they're right. Just open for supper. Which, what's the difference between supper and dinner?
Yeah, we've lost the term a little bit. Right?
Supper is a very Wisconsin-y word for dinner, isn't it?
Exactly.
Thank you, Ron.
I hear it a lot in Wisconsin. Thanks, Ron.
And I thought it's a different time thing. Like, dinner is typically...
Well, I think it used to be on the farm, you'd have dinner at lunchtime, and supper was a light supper.
You know, so the Last Supper could have taken place in Wisconsin, for all we know. The Last Supper Club. That's if I ever had a religious restaurant, it would be called the Last Supper Club.
Why don't you open one up in your house, in your kitchen?
Party of 13.
There was a deer head in that picture, and they took it out. There was actually some twinkly lights.
Tom, cool. We only have a couple of minutes, but you have a supper club you'd like to share?
Well, my grandfather took me to a place when I was a kid. It was right up by Great America in Gurnee. It was called Rustic Manor. And they had the relish trays, but it was almost a taxidermy shop.
Sounds like it qualifies.
Yeah.
And it was perfect. And I went there as a kid, and I took my wife on our first date there.
Aww.
And then when I asked her to marry me, I took her there again. And it burnt down, but there was so much taxidermy. The food was always fantastic. And like you said, it was just very homey. But it was a special place, and I always thought of it as a supper club in Illinois.
You know of it, right, Ron?
Well, I don't, but it shares a common trait with all Wisconsin supper clubs is they've had a devastating fire at some point.
That's because all the taxidermy. It goes up really quickly.
Exactly. They're all smoking later and, you know, falling asleep.
But. Tom, thank you for calling.
Isn't that true, though? I know you're half kidding, but you're not.
No,
they all do have big fires at some point.
And that's when they add on the new dining room or the kitchen. And
right.
That's not a selling point, guys. real quickly, is this Marion? Hi, Marion.
Yes, yes. When I was a child, 5 and 6, and now I'm 60, my parents used to go to the Barn of Barrington, and it had a very horsey theme. They always had the Triple Crown winners listed and a piano player that was there that would play while you waited for your table.
That sounds like a supper club.
Yeah.
And that's a big place, by the way. That was a huge... Barn of Barrington was gigantic.
Yeah, it sounds good to me. I mean, and especially with a piano, you know, music was a big attraction for some of these places. So.
Yes, and my parents always remind me how I would always do ballet for the piano player.
No.
So I'm that. 40 years old, my mother would go, "You are so cute, you can't ballet for the piano player." I was like, "Oh, so thank you so much."
Thank you for sharing.
Thanks, Marion.
We appreciate it.
Ron, I'm so happy. A second version of the Wisconsin Supper Club books, this one called Wisconsin Supper Clubs, Another Round. Ron Fayola is his name. And also there is a documentary that, as we were alluding to earlier, tell people how they can see that.
Right. Well, it's really only available on DVD right now. So if you go to supperclubmovie.com or supperclubbook.com, you can see the trailer and order it if you want. But it's been on PBS. I'm not sure if they still have the license or not, but it's been available since 2011. So.
Excellent.
So
excellent.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Thank you, Ron.
Thanks for having me.
Greatly appreciated. Again, the book is Wisconsin Supper Clubs, Another Round, and that's Ron Fayola. We'll take a quick break and find out what Steve has next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Thank you, Ryan. Hi, everybody. It's Bill and Wendy back for the second half of our program. Please call in or text in anytime you want, 312-981-7200. We'd love to hear from you.
You sound desperate.
please call in. You're our only hope.
We're going to get a GoFundMe page for you to call in.
Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're our only hope. Name that movie.
I don't know.
All right.
The Hobbit?
Yep, it's The Hobbit. I wish we had prizes. We don't have any prizes.
Give myself a prize.
Did you see this? I love this. Here's a chance. This is a chance of a lifetime for somebody to have free hamburgers for the rest of their life. All they need to do is change their last name to Burger, and they will get free hamburgers.
What if your last name is already Burger?
You know what? My cousins, that is their last name.
With
and
a U?
Probably
an E.
With an E.
They got to change it.
They want it spelled B-U-R-G-E-R, the traditional hamburger way.
How many times did they get teased growing up? Did people go, oh, do you have a brother Ham?
Oh, I never thought of that. That would be an easy way to tease my own cousins. I wish I had thought of that, Wendy. Why didn't I know you when I was little? I could have teased them. Mr. Burger is the name of the hamburger chain. It's a medium-sized upmarket burger chain based in Australia. They want to help by giving somebody free hamburgers for life. And like I said, all you need to do is change your name to Burger. The Melbourne-based restaurant is offering a lifetime supply of burgers if you formally change your last name.
So you would be Mr. Burger. So Mr. obviously Burger. This is a sexist contest because it couldn't be Mrs. Burger.
You know, it doesn't say that they would exclude women.
Yeah,
it
but the name of the place is
Mr. Burger. Right.
They're still missing the boat here because most people, even if you changed your name,
yeah.
You'd still go by Bill Burger.
Billy Burger. I would go Billy Burger. Wouldn't you? Doesn't that sound more fun?
Given the option, yes.
Billy Burger.
Burger. So.
And I would always wear, instead of a hat, like I usually wear a baseball cap, I would wear lettuce and mayonnaise.
And a bun.
And a bun.
Just a sesame seed top?
Probably.
Would you get shoes that look like the bottom part of the bun?
Boy, I hadn't thought of that, but I bet that would be even better. I bet that would. Even the Mr. Burger Company would say to me, could you just tone it down a bit? What's wrong with you? We're giving you free burgers. Don't act like an idiot. They would even say that.
But they're missing the boat. It's like, you know, because it's just Mr. Burger. And if you just changed your name to Billy Burger,
right.
No one calls you Mr. Left.
No, that's true. Nobody does. You'd think in some official capacity someone would. They don't.
All right. Your girl's friends don't call you Mr. Left?
Nope.
What do they call you?
Bill. I like it better that way. Mr. Left sounds way too serious for me.
See, I was in a quandary when the kids got to be old enough. As little kids, you'd say, hey, say hi to the neighbor, Jack. So it'd be like, hi, Jack. And then don't say that on a plane.
Right,
and
ever.
Then now that they're older, I feel like they should show respect by saying Mr. So now they call him Mr. Jack.
Mr. Jack. That doesn't sound right, though.
You'd be Mr. Bill.
I would be Mr. Bill.
Oh, no.
You know what's strange? I thought about this a couple of weeks ago. In our family, and this is predominantly on my wife's side, although I think it's on my side too, but I notice this a lot more on my wife's side because we're with those relatives more often. None of the kids call their aunts or uncles because I'm an uncle by several of them. I'm an uncle to 2, 4, 5, 6, 7 kids now. None of them referred to me as Uncle Bill, and not just me, but any of their aunts or
uncles.
They
just call them their first name?
It's just Bill.
My brother made his kids say auntie or uncle.
Do you prefer that?
They still to this day say Aunt Wendy, although my sister is like you when she signs cards. Like I'll sign cards Aunt Wendy.
You will, yeah?
She just signs it Betsy. She doesn't put aunt.
I
like the moniker.
The formality yes. of having the aunt or uncle before it. It didn't happen on purpose. I don't know why it happened, but just from the time any of them were little, they would just say my name or any of their other aunts or uncles. There was never an aunt or uncle before any of them. And I don't know if that's common with other people. I hadn't even thought about it until recently.
Can I tell you the weirdest thing is when, you know, you have friends from elementary school or something and you've always called their parents Mr. and Mrs. and now you see them as an adult, you still call them Mr. or Mrs., but you feel stupid.
It's strange, isn't it?
It is really weird.
And they will invariably at some point say, you know what, just call us Lonnie and Bob. And
no one's ever said that
to me. Your names aren't Lonnie or Bob. Why would I call you guys Lonnie and Bob?
No parent of my friends have ever said, just call us by our first name.
Oh, no?
No, it's just that's how we originally met them. So it's still to this day. My girlfriend's dad, Gail, just celebrated his 90th birthday or 93rd, and it would be Mr. Jage. I couldn't call him Eddie Spaghetti.
No. Why would you do that? My mom became friends with a couple of my teachers or my brother's teachers over the years. And at some point, as we got older, they'd say, you don't have to call us Mrs. whatever their last name was anymore. Just call us. And then the first, and I'd go, oh, no, I can't do that.
You can't do that. Mm-mm. And when I send emails to the school, if I have correspondence, it's like Mr. Becker or Mr. Tarantino.
Right.
I can't call them by their first name. Like, they'll sign their name. They don't sign it Mr. They right. sign it their first name. But I feel funny calling
it's
them
strange,
by their first
isn't
name.
It? Is Quentin Tarantino a teacher at yes. your kid's school? That's intense. That would be a very intense class. Now, with Mr. Berger, here's a little inside information. I don't know if WGN listeners know this or not, but there was a time where Mark Cuban, who is the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, had a deal going. Now, I guess now everybody kind of knows Mark Cuban because he's on Shark Tank, and he's made a pretty good name for himself. All right, so we're going back around... oh, maybe 10 years ago, he had a publicity stunt going where he selected a couple of key media people in each city and offered them a very large sum of money if they would change their name to Dallas Maverick.
That's a great name, first of all.
It sounds like it's got something to it. But one of the people he was considering, and I believe made a formal offer to, was a then WGN employee. He doesn't work here anymore. Can you guess who it is?
An on-air person?
An on-air person.
John Williams.
No, it's not John Williams. But he made, because this is a person I've known for over 10 years now, and I remember him coming to me saying, look, here's what they're doing. They've offered me a huge sum of money, and it was really decent money.
Like how much?
In the hundreds of thousands.
And did he do it?
He did not do it.
What a dummy. I had to
right.
edit myself.
Do you want to know who it is?
Yeah, wait, give me a hint.
He worked here until
Spike.
This year. No. Sometimes he's ridiculous.
Oh, there is no way Dave Kaplan would give up his name
ever. It was
ever.
David Kaplan.
There
Mark
is
Cuban
no
was going to give him a
do you
huge
think that
truckload
guy
of
would
money.
Ever
he was
his
so
name?
Close. He was going
to do you remember
do
this, Steve?
There were official talks and people had to talk him down from
I know.
It.
Why
I know.
I would do it.
But then,
and then you do sports. That's a great name for a sportscaster.
But imagine having to report on the Bulls' scores and the Bulls' team, and your name is one of their opponents.
Yeah, but that's okay.
No, but the radio station, you know, you don't want the Sports Plus with Dallas Maverick.
Well, then the radio station should have given him the hundreds of thousands of dollars not to do it. Kaplan's a genius.
An evil genius.
A ridiculous genius.
Ridiculously dressed genius.
But he was so, like, he was going back and forth. Like, every time I talked to him, I've decided I'm going to do it. From now on, I'm Dallas Maverick.
He was so fired up. It was
and then the
so
next
funny.
Time you'd see him, I'm not doing it. It's stupid.
I got too much pride.
Talked to Jim Hickman. He told me not to do it.
You guys got good conversations. Well, maybe I got better conversations. I learned about his... his tandem colonoscopy with his wife.
Yeah.
That's a great date night, Dave.
Yep.
I was kind of knocked out, but we were holding hands. All right, great.
I wasn't a hand.
So you would do that. If an owner of a sports team came to you and said, here's just an insane amount of money, but from here on in, your name is not Wendy Snyder. It is San Antonio Spur. You would go, I would take that.
That doesn't have the ring to it like Dallas Maverick.
Yeah? So you would do it based on which name it was? That's how you would decide?
Well, yeah. Dallas Maverick sounds like a name.
It sounds like a name of an NBA team, though. It just does.
Change your name to Chicago Bull.
All right. There's your hypothetical. They come to you and they say, look, you're in Chicago. The Bulls are our team. All you have to be is Chicago Bull from here on in.
St. Louis Ram is coming over.
Was that you, Steve? You'd do that?
Think about it.
Did anybody do it?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know.
That Mark Cuban.
I know nobody locally did it. I know that for sure, but I wonder if nationally he found somebody to do it.
Well, if you lived in Dallas your whole life, why wouldn't you
then
do
it? Then it's something, I guess. But then you're kind of a joke, aren't you?
A rich joke.
A rich joke. Right. You would be.
And why doesn't he run for vice president with Trump?
Who?
Mark Cuban.
Mark Cuban? Not with Trump, but on his own. He's not a fan of Trump's. He said that more than once.
I can't keep track of who is and who isn't.
Who is not on his team. All right, we're getting a bunch of phone calls. Give us a call. It's 312-981-7200. We'll get to those calls next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
What a great song for today.
This is the perfect song for today. If you were offered a lot of money to change your name to a corporate brand, would you do that? Mr. Burger is doing that out in Australia, and Mark Cuban did that here in the States. He wanted somebody to change their name to Dallas Mavericks, including our own David, our formerly owned David Kaplan.
Our formerly owned?
Yeah, he's no longer our own.
All right, and Jim, listener Jim, has a Dave Kaplan story.
Oh.
We're all ears.
Then Sheryl Crow hit on him once.
On David Kaplan?
She would wait for him after, yeah. She was at a restaurant. He was doing a remote. She said she'd wait for him after the show.
Wow.
Because I'm married. She said, well, I can still meet you after the show.
I'm holding out for Alanis Morissette. She's more fun in a movie theater.
But she's got one hand in her pocket.
A song about him, like Taylor.
About David Kaplan? I would love that song. Yeah. I'd listen to that every day.
All right, so that's what he claimed?
Yeah.
Is there any proof to this?
And if he changed, by the way, then he could ride in the jet for free, I would suppose. He'd say he owned it.
Maybe. Thanks. Thank you, Jim.
That's ridiculous.
That's ridiculous.
Somebody said Mark Cuban has offered to run for vice president with Hillary Clinton to defeat Trump.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Hillary's not going to let him do
it. He's no. But I wonder, Mark Cuban is an interesting guy. I wonder if he is eyeing something politically down the road. There's a chance of it.
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet you're right.
Maybe.
Somebody thinks that Charlotte Hornet would be a nice name for me.
That would be a great name for you. That would really
Who's
be
a going to pay me a couple $150,000?
No, it's always got to be money.
Well, yeah. Why else would I change my name? I didn't want to change my name when I got married and Jim made me. Because I get to keep Wendy Snyder on the air.
On air,
but
original.
Legally, I'm a McInerney.
Oh.
He made me.
Oh, that doesn't seem right. I'm surprised you gave in to that.
I loved him.
I guess.
Still do. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, hi. I was commenting on the Mr. and Mrs. you were talking about.
Yes.
But basically, I worked for a doctor for a lot of years, and of course, it was always Dr. David. Well, when we'd see each other in a social situation, you know, I'd introduce him to my husband, and he says, hi, I'm David. I could not call him David. It had to be always Doctor. It was just, you know.
A habit.
It was like that was, yeah, it was his name, Dr. David. It wasn't David. And I think that that Charlotte name would be perfect for you. I like that.
Charlotte Hornet.
Isn't that a great
yeah,
name?
Yeah, I like it. It Thank sounds you. Like a stripper name.
Somebody said that Dallas Maverick sounds
so,
like
back,
a.
Let's back up there. So you just said a stripper name would be perfect for Wendy. Is that what you said?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Somebody said Dallas Maverick sounds like a porn star name, and it does.
Boy, it does.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You guys have a great day.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
You too, Nancy. She was filled with vim and vigor, wasn't
She's
she?
She's the Oakland Raider.
Right.
Somebody else had something to say about the Mr. and Mrs. My nephews and niece are adults. Always called me Ellen, like you. It just happened. I wanted to be called Aunt. I sign all the cards, Aunt Ellen, but they just call her Ellen. You can request it.
You can request it, but it depends on, like for me, because my name is Bill, obviously.
It is?
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Look at my name tag. What does it say? Bill.
Hello, my name is Bill.
Hello, my name is Bill. How may I serve you? It was weird to hear. It would have been weird to hear them say Uncle Bill, because in my head, that's Family Affair. Yeah, it's Buffy and Jody and Sissy. And I don't know. I guess it would have grown on me. But I thought it was cool that everybody on my wife's side, and I guess everybody, yeah, like my brother's daughter just calls me Bill. It's never Uncle Bill.
We're all aunt and uncle in our family.
You are? Yeah. I think that's the way it usually is.
Someone wants to know if you have to move to Australia to get the free burgers, because he's thinking about it.
That's a great question. My guess is yes, because I don't know that they'd need publicity here in the United States. They don't exist here.
Somebody wants you to name yourself Portland Trailblazer.
All right. For $100. My price isn't quite as high as David Kaplan's. I'll do it for $100, but it has to be cash. I'm no fool.
And here is the weirdest thing ever when you are seeing former teachers and stuff, and I just can't call them by their first name. Even though they sign emails that way, and at the parent-teacher conference, they'll, you know, hi, I'm so-and-so.
And not even your teachers. These are your kids' teachers.
That's what I'm talking about. And 630 says, I went back to teach with my former teachers. Talk about having a difficult time. It took a year to feel comfortable calling them by their first name. She went to work at a school that she went to.
I don't think I'd ever be able to pull that off. Because part of my brain would just go, that's wrong. You can't do that. It would just feel dirty somehow. Like I have no right to call them by their regular name. It's always Mr. or Miss or Mrs.
Or the kids today just say Ms.
Yeah, I get it. I hear that a lot too.
Even though most of them are Mrs., they still say Ms.
All right. This is really weird. Tell me if you've ever experienced this. When I was a kid, I noticed a lot of kids didn't understand that Mrs. simply meant it was a woman who was married as opposed to Miss, because I had a bunch of friends that would always call a woman by the wrong prefix.
Yes.
And now I've noticed a lot of that with my daughter's friends are the same way. Like they'll call my wife Miss Leff when obviously she's married to me. But then other women in the town, spinsters, who are not married, they will say the opposite. They'll say Mrs. when it's a Miss. Like they don't understand. This is an easy one to figure out. Married is Mrs., not married is Miss. That's really simple. But they don't seem to understand that simple, basic rule.
Well, wasn't that why Ms. came up? Because a Mr., you would call a man Mr. whether he was married or not. And with women, it was Miss or Mrs. And we wanted to be as ambiguous as the Mr. And that's why Ms. came up.
I thought it was because women wanted to establish the fact that their marriage had nothing to do with their prefix. That it was more of a liberation thing, as if to say, don't define us, don't throw us a prefix just because we're married or not. Find some common ground in the middle.
Yeah, but I mean, like, Mr., we can't tell.
It's always the same.
We don't know if you're married or single.
Right.
We know you're married, and tomorrow's your 25th anniversary.
Yes. Yes.
I can't believe.
See you at the Steak and Shake. We're living it up.
Well, congratulations. We have a very quick amount of time to talk to April. Hi, April.
Hey, guys. Just want to let you know, I have a nephew who's almost 12, and out of nowhere, he's decided that I'm no longer anti-April. I'm just April.
For no reason? Nothing happened?
No reason. I'm like, dude, it's anti or aunt.
So, see, you want the title. I like the title.
I do, too. I have aunts who are in their 70s. I still call them auntie.
Did you talk to the kid's parents about this?
Yeah, it's my sister. I'm like, where'd this come from? It's like, you know, I'm proud of the fact that I'm an aunt.
Yeah, sure.
No gifts until he calls you Aunt April again.
Exactly.
That's fair. Thanks, April, or Aunt April.
Sure.
I don't want to get on April's bad side. I'll go with Aunt April.
It's weird when my kids call me by my first name, but if we're out somewhere and they say mom, a lot of times I don't hear that. So then they'll go, Wendy.
Yeah.
And
it gets your attention.
Yeah, but it's weird coming from my kids.
I know. I'm sure of it. All right, we'll take a quick break. Steve has the news, and then we have a lot more coming out for you. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Well, I've been looking forward to this for a couple of days now. Here's what it is. On February the 3rd, 1959, that is commonly referred to as the day the music died.
And they were singing.
Right. It's been immortalized in song. People have talked about it for years and years. That's the day that we lost not one, not two, but three big music stars all in the same airplane crash. You can name them, can't you?
Why? Because you can't?
No, I know all three.
Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
Big Bopper.
Yeah. One more.
Eddie Cochran? No.
Richie Valens.
Richie Valens.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Richie Valens. All right. So that, of course, a very important milestone day for music. But our next guest, Hans Feeney, the Reverend Hans Feeney from the River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois, says that October 15th, 2004 is the night that comedy died. Thank you for joining us, Reverend. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you guys doing?
Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. We're doing great. Please explain. We get the one about the day the music died, but why on October 15th, 2004 was that the night that late night comedy died?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the distinction. There's not comedy itself more so much, but I would say late night comedy. Well, so that was the day when Jon Stewart went on his famous appearance on Crossfire when Paul Begala and Tucker Carlson were hosting, and he kind of went into his big speech about how their sort of the format of their show and their way of discussing political issues was hurting America, and I think that was kind of the point at which his role was changed both in the eyes of the audience and probably a bit in the eyes of himself as well. I think, and that was kind of the moment when the Daily Show went from just sort of being a program where he would kind of mock news coverage, and when he kind of received all of this praise and adulation for in a humorous way, kind of telling people the proper way to talk about politics, kind of eventually transitioned into telling people what they ought to think about politics themselves with kind of enough jokes sort of peppered in. So it's kind of the way I would describe it is it was a transition from being from comedy into what I would call advocacy with jokes.
Do you remember, Hans, were you watching at the time? Did you see it happening live?
I saw it right around when it happened. I don't know if I saw the actual live broadcast of it, but yeah, I was in college at the time.
And were you
shortly after college?
Like, did you understand the cultural impact of what that event could be, or what did you think when it was first happening?
When I first saw it, I remembered kind of agreeing with him to a certain extent. You know, I think unless you're a terribly partisan person, I don't really consider myself terribly political. Certainly not being a pastor. I don't talk politics at church at all. I remember just kind of thinking, well, you know, it would probably be nice to have for people who aren't kind of interested so much in that game of that kind of back and forth. And want to just kind of hear a thoughtful exchange of ideas. It certainly seemed like a nice plea. So I don't know that what he was saying in that context is necessarily something I would disagree with. I just think that strikes me as the moment when that kind of a little bit changed the directory of the Daily Show itself, but also, and this is kind of more what I talk about in the piece, changed the way that late night comedy saw itself and saw what its role was.
I hate politics. I hate politics. I hate talking politics. But in this day and age, I feel like if you don't talk about what's going on in the world, you're kind of missing the boat. I somewhat agree with you, Reverend Feeney, because Letterman didn't get very political. It was funny, goofy stuff.
Well, Letterman became more political as time went on.
Right.
And that's when I wasn't as interested in him.
Oh.
I mean, it's kind of an escape. You think of Johnny Carson, you think of, you know, I just watched the video that somebody put on their Facebook page. Frank Sinatra's there. All of a sudden, Don Rickles. It's just like a laugh fest. It's just kind of like a fun thing to do. And the good news is Jon Stewart helped make people think about things. And more people were talking politics. But that's not what I want. So I kind of agree with you, Reverend Feeney. I wouldn't watch it as much because I don't want to hear the political views. Show me the funny.
Yeah, I think, and that's kind of the point I was trying to make in the piece. I had a number of people respond. I don't know if it's people's reading comprehension skills are going down these days, or I think it's maybe that people are just so used to reading stuff that fits with their preconceived notions, and they're so used to arguing that it's almost like they think you're going to say one thing, and then when you say another thing, they go, "Well, I already sort of wrote my speech for you know what you're going to say."
Yeah.
And so some of the criticism I got from people was sort of this notion that I'm saying that there's no place for this kind of Jon Stewart influence type of humor. And I wasn't at all saying that. I mean, I think, you know, even though he didn't start The Daily Show, the program really didn't find its identity until he kind of crafted it into what it is. And, you know, a lot of the kind of clones of The Daily Show, you know, with the Colbert Report from a few years ago and Samantha Bee's new show on, I think it's TBS, and you know, some other programs like that. That's not necessarily the kind of stuff I'm terribly interested in watching, but I don't begrudge anyone for doing that. There's obviously an audience for it, and it's a fine way of trying to do things. But yeah, I just think it's more so, I think where it's been problematic has been in kind of pre-existing comedic institutions that really weren't that before, you know. So stuff like the, you know, the late night shows, Tonight Show, and I think, for example, where you see a lot of this influence is now in David Letterman's old show with Stephen Colbert, and then Late Night with Seth Meyers now, which are very much more like The Daily Show now. There's a lot more, you know, kind of fake news anchor reading the news into the camera and sort of, you know, peppering in jokes while you're sort of telling people what they ought to think about, you know, about these various stories. And it's, you know, that's fine for kind of other programs. But yeah, if you're someone who just wants to kind of be able to escape from this stuff, you know, as you're winding down for the night and just sort of have a collective laugh at how sort of absurd the entire world is.
Kind of like Weekend Update on SNL. That's what I kind of am looking
right
for. I like that better.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, right, and I, you know, I'm a Norm Macdonald guy. This, I suppose, one of the best ways to start fights with people is to talk about who you think the best Weekend Update host was. And I definitely was a Norm Macdonald guy. I'm kind of the school of thought that that a comedian's job is to kind of stand above the idiocy of the world and to use humor as a means to kind of, as a sort of like a rope to lift you up out of it so you can laugh at everything with them. You know, whereas I see the Stewart model is more kind of, we're going to sort of sludge through the mud of the world and get to the place where we want to be, and I'll sort of keep it entertaining along the way. And yeah, and I'm much more akin to the sort of the Norm Macdonald approach to things. I think even now, if you watch the Weekend Update, you know, they've got one of their hosts or anchors, Michael Che, is a Daily School graduate, and it has much more of a Daily School kind of feel now, where it's I think more advocacy with jokes than it is just sort of pure comedy kind of standing above everything, which if you like that kind of thing is fine, but if you're the kind of person who sort of liked the thing you already had the way it was and don't want it to kind of be infected with this other approach to things, it's not always as enjoyable.
I'm anxious to hear Bill's take on this, because a former stand-up comic and you're a really funny guy. I want to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, there's so much. Oh, if you're just joining us, by the way, Hans Feeney is our guest, a reverend at the River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois, and the piece that he's referred to that he's written is on thefederalist.com. That's where we found it, and I loved it. I thought it was a well-researched and extremely well-written piece, Hans. Really nicely done. I agree with you on so many points, especially Norm Macdonald, who's one of the most underrated comics politically and otherwise of all time. He's so good. But I would say this to you, even though that night might have been very significant, that October night in 2004 on Crossfire with Jon Stewart, there's so many examples of earlier instances. For instance, so many episodes of Bill Maher's show, Politically Incorrect, which preceded that, kind of dealt with exactly this, don't you think?
Well, yeah, I would say so, although I don't know, and I don't mean this as an insult to Bill Maher, I don't know that I would really call Bill Maher a comedian. I mean, I know he's done a lot of stand-up, but that's kind of his shtick has always sort of been predominantly, I'm going to tell you the way that things are and the way that you should think about these sort of various issues and do it in a kind of comedic fashion. I mean, if I can, I suppose I can defer to Norm Macdonald here, who we've already invoked a couple of times.
Are you president of the Norm Macdonald fan club, by the way? Because we love him too.
If there is, I would love to be it. He's just wonderful. But I read something from Norm Macdonald a couple years ago that basically just said he doesn't really view Bill Maher as a comedian. He thinks he's a, you know, very smart and insightful guy. But I think his kind of main thing is not really comedy.
I'd agree. I'm not a fan of Bill Maher at all.
No.
Not at all. He's just, and not that he's not talented and he is very bright. It's just not my cup of tea.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think it is similar to, and I brought this up in the article, so I run a YouTube channel and a just kind of a multimedia thing called Lutheran Satire. It's very kind of small beans, obviously, compared to all of this, and it's, I'm certainly not as, wouldn't ever compare myself to Jon Stewart in terms of my level of my comedic chops or things of that nature. But I started doing this a few years ago because I found out in trying to teach people theology and teach them what our church teaches, I found that humor is a really useful teaching device. It's, you know, you're able to kind of get things across in a much briefer span of time than oftentimes you can otherwise. But what I would never call comedy, because my goal is to teach people what I think is true, what I think is good and what they ought to believe, and to just sort of do it with jokes to kind of keep them, you know, sort of trekking along with.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's not, so it's, so to me, I kind of, yeah, I think I use this example in the piece. It would be like, you know, if for some crazy reason in some weird alternate universe, NBC were to call me up and say, hey, can you please host The Tonight Show and tell lots of jokes about, you know, the Augsburg Confession and the Council of Trent. Now, I would gladly take the opportunity.
Would I? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But I would completely understand if people turned it on and they're going, well, why is this show now catechism class with jokes? This is not, you know, this is not what I signed up for. This is not the thing I kind of grew up, you know, watching and loving. Although I have kind of wondered if I think maybe some of the change with this is that, because, you know, before the days of YouTube and DVRs, the only way you were able to watch these shows was if you just stayed up late and watched them as you were going to bed.
Yeah.
And I think that might be part of the change, is because, it, you know, it's one thing to kind of watch a four-minute, five-minute sketch or rant or whatever it is in the middle of the day. But when you're kind of, you know, being lulled to sleep and you're kind of just wanting some entertainment to kind of unwind before you go to bed, there aren't a whole lot of people that I think that want to just, like, get angry about politics.
Right.
And want to laugh while, like, feeling morally superior to the other side, you know, as they're going off to bed. It was, you know, usually you watch kind of some guests goof around, and then, you know, then you'd say, all right, who's the musical guest? You know, the Gin Blossoms? No, I'm going to bed, you know, and that,
right.
that type of thing. And so I wonder if that has kind of changed some of this, too, is that if you're no longer in a place where people are primarily consuming this as they're lying in bed waiting to go to sleep, that might kind of very well change the type of audience that you get.
That's a great point.
Hans Feeney is our guest. He's a reverend at the River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois, and a senior contributor to The Federalist. That's a web magazine. Go to thefederalist.com to read his piece, How Jon Stewart Killed Late Night Comedy. We'll come back with more. If you want to jump in, we're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
I think we just learned that Reverend Hans Feeney would not stay up late to catch the Gin Blossoms when they were on.
No, he would not.
Letterman.
Nope. Hans Feeney is a reverend at the River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois, senior contributor for The Federalist. And go to that website, thefederalist.com, to read his piece, his very insightful piece, How Jon Stewart Killed Late Night Comedy. I have to say, Hans, I'm extremely impressed. I normally don't think of reverends as having that big of a background in comedy, but you really do seem to know your stuff.
Well, I've always been a big fan of the stuff. I mean, I used to watch Jon Stewart's old MTV show, which was, I don't know, that was a handful of years before The Daily Show. And, well, the thing is, I think in order to be a comedian, you have to be pretty cynical. And that's also, if you believe, as I do, that all people are born in sin and have a sinful nature, then you have that kind of that same pastoral cynicism, you know, going into any situation. I think they're actually fairly similar vocations, in lots of ways. I'd imagine too, one of them being that, like, if both of you are a comedian and you're a pastor, you always have people telling you, you're a comedian, that's great. Let me tell you about this comedian I really love who you think is terrible. And then you just go, oh, gosh.
Right.
Know? So
right.
It's like, you know, you work hard to craft your act, and someone's like, oh, my gosh, my wife and I just saw Carrot Top, and he was great. And you're going, oh, yeah, that's, you know. And as a Lutheran pastor, you know, people go, oh, you're a Lutheran pastor, that's great. I just read Joel Osteen's greatest book and latest book, and you're going, okay, yeah, well. All right. Nice.
Boy, you make church fun. I can see your teachings to the students about the Lutheran faith. When it's funny and you're having fun, it captures your attention, and in essence, you learn more.
Yeah, well, then that's, I think, the main goal of it is just to kind of keep people, when they're waiting for sort of the punchline to drop, you know, then it keeps their attention a little bit more keyed in.
Hans, I have to say, since you brought up Joel Osteen, when I watch him, of all the quote-unquote televangelists I've ever seen, he seems to have figured out to use the same pattern as most stand-up comics. His setup, there is a setup punchline approach to the way he preaches. You recognize that, don't you?
Well, I'd actually never thought about that before. I just noticed his pearly white Osmond teeth.
Yes,
and that helps. If you got a set of teeth like that, there's hardly anything you can do wrong.
Right.
But no, that's a very interesting observation. I'm going to have to go back and listen for that kind of that cadence. I suppose.
Yep, it's there.
I was just listening, and I think this was happening on the morning show with Steve Cochran. I can't remember, but somebody was saying how they're not a fan of Jimmy Fallon's because he's not really a good interviewer. All he does is get these people on and do goofy things with them. I love that. I mean, it's a matter of taste, you know?
Well, the thing is, look, what celebrities have interesting things to say?
President Obama, but I thought him singing was
fine.
you know, doing the music news or whatever they call it. That was great. Yeah. I loved that.
Yeah.
Well, and I suppose it's nice to have, you know, have one moment where, regardless of what you think about the president, so you got people who love him and people who don't. So I suppose it's nice if you can have, you know, have the leader of the free world on TV and not have half of the country wanting to pull their hair out at that any given moment. So I suppose that's nice.
This question is unfair to ask you since we only have a minute. So I hate to, but give us a quick answer if you can. How should, when the biggest story in the country, if not the world, is American politics, is Trump, you know, this businessman that nobody expected to get this far, getting this far, how do you not address it on these late night shows? You almost have to, don't you?
Well, yeah, I don't think you don't. What I'm looking for, at least for myself, is I don't think it's a matter of not approaching politics at all, because all of it is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, you know, in the end, you're just sort of looking for, well, in the midst of all of this absurdity, what's sort of the, you know, the best option? But everything about politics is absurd. Everything about the whole concept of it and the execution of it is just silly. So I think ultimately what you want to aim for is just something that just sort of looks at the absurdity of all of it and kind of invites everyone to laugh, you know. And I think that's what I think is kind of missing in the Jon Stewart approach and kind of the influence that some of those who have come out of that school have had, is that they're willing to alienate sort of half the audience and kind of prevent them from being able to be a part of the joke and being able to laugh in order to drive home a point. You know, and if that's what you're looking for, that's fine. But if you're part of that 50% that's getting alienated, you know, regardless of who they're lampooning, you know, I think there's just something that's much more inclusive and much more enjoyable when you're just kind of sort of trying to throw a laugh at the absurdity of everything party and everyone gets invited.
I can't tell you over the years how many stand-ups I've talked to who have said essentially that I don't do any politics because I know as I'm doing the joke on stage, half the audience immediately doesn't like me because I'm making fun of their guy or their girl.
Right.
So there's something to that. Hans, it was so much fun talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it. The piece is so well written.
Sorry, Bill. What's your YouTube channel if people want to watch that?
Lutheran Satire is just the name of it. And they can also check it out at lutheransatire.org.
Hans Feeney, again, reverend over at the River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan and senior contributor for The Federalist. That's the website that has the piece. We're talking about how Jon Stewart killed late night comedy. It's thefederalist.com. Hans, thanks again. Have a great weekend.
Hey, you too.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
We'll take a quick break, and then we'll find out what's in the news next with Steve. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
All right, summer is here, and typically the Snyder Max go to our little beach club in southern Illinois. It's not there for our south, really, but I'm a little scared to go to the beach club this year because there's something known as Negleri Falleri. I'm probably saying it wrong,
doesn't it?
I will say it in terms that you will understand. It's called the brain. It's referred to as the brain-eating amoeba.
Imagine that.
I can't imagine this. This deadly bug can be picked up from warm freshwater lakes. So if you're swimming in Lake Michigan, you probably will be okay because it's a big lake and cooler. But these small water-in holes that I go to, I don't know if I can go to it this summer. On the line with us right now is ABC News correspondent Mark Remillard.
Hey,
what
Mark.
Is going on with this thing, and how do you really say it? Negleria fowleri.
I believe it's Negleria fowleri, believe is how you pronounce it.
Thank you.
But the good news is that it's very, very rare to have this happen. And there's really only one way that you can get infected with this amoeba. The water, if you're swimming or even contaminated tap waters and things like that, it has to go up into your nose, and then the amoeba will stick to the mucous membranes in your nose, and then and from there it attacks your brain. While it is very rare, it is also very fatal. Over 97% of people who are infected end up dying.
In like 12 days, doesn't it happen like bing, bang, boom, that's it?
In some cases it takes a number of days for it to for the symptoms to start appearing, and you get symptoms like meningitis, you get the stiff neck, headaches, these kinds of things, and then from there it progresses.
Where did this come from? This is a fairly new thing. Why all of a sudden do we have to worry about this?
Well, I think it's not new in terms of that this is an organism that's been around. The discovery of this is not new, but what has happened is actually You've seen there was a girl, an 18-year-old girl in North Carolina who died of this just a few weeks ago, earlier this month. And so I think that's helped bring it to the forefront again. And then what happened, and the reason that we're discussing it now, is there's a doctor who's from the Bay Area. She specializes in infectious diseases. She lost her son to this back in 2009, and she's actually started putting up a billboard in Florida telling people about this. And there's obviously a lot of lakes and vacationing in Florida, and the South is one area that's where this amoeba predominantly can be found.
The water's obviously warmer there. As far as I could tell with my research, there have been no cases in Illinois at this point. It's present in fresh water across the United States, and symptoms appear about 5 days after a nasal exposure. And I read somewhere, Mark, that you, like, if you get water in your mouth, it's not a big deal. They're not concerned with that. It's going up only the nasal passages. So they're suggesting wearing the nose plugs when you go swimming.
Those clips.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. There's only one way that you can get infected by this, and it's the water going up your nose. Even if you drink contaminated water with this amoeba in it, you won't get infected. So certainly that's the warning that this doctor with the who had her son die to this, her 10-year-old son, she's recommending people wear these nose clips. And, you know, it's something to think about, too, that it's not just lakes. It can be streams. It could be your tap water. There was a case, I'm not sure exactly what year it was, but there was one person who was infected from the tap water on a slip and slide. So you have to be aware of that as well. Any fresh water, warm fresh water that's unchlorinated could potentially have this, and so that's why they recommend wearing those nose clips.
Mark, when we had this horrible story about the little boy in Disney World with the alligator a little over a week ago, several sources said that they're just now coming off of the concern in Disney of exactly the same virus in the water there in Seven Seas Lagoon. I don't even remember hearing about it there until after we had that horrible story about the kid with the alligator. Do you?
I had not heard that, but again, there have been numerous cases of this. Again, it's very rare, but there have been numerous cases of this occurring in Florida. And for example, not too far away, Polk County, which is just outside of Tampa and in between Orlando, that's where this doctor had her son become infected with this, and he later succumbed to it. So Florida being what it is, and we know the large amount of lakes that they have in that state, many of them fresh water like that, and that warm water, there's the potential for it being there.
All right, what about water parks? Is that because there's a sort
chlorine,
of safe because of the chlorine?
Those would probably be chlorinated, exactly. Again, if it's under-chlorinated or not well-kept, there's certainly that chance. But again, if it's a, you know, a reputable business, you would assume that they would be chlorinating it.
I snort chlorine first thing in the morning every day, Mark, just to be safe.
Wake you up, huh? Yeah, wake you up and get you going. Yeah.
We're getting some quotes from the Advocate Christ Medical Center in Oak Lawn. Most cases occur in the South, although more recent cases have been reported in Minnesota and Ohio. It's working its way close to us. And what fun is swimming if you have to hold your nose? And how do you hold your nose when you're doing a handstand underwater?
Well, exactly, and that's why you got to get those clips. You know, they're of course very fashionable as well. Those
yes, they
those
are.
Brightly colored nose clips that you can put on. Nobody will make fun of you for that. But that's one way that you can do a handstand underwater.
Mark, do we expect this now to be a reality from this day forward? This isn't something that's going to be eradicated. This will always exist, won't it?
Yeah, there's really no way. From some of the research that I've been looking into this, there's really not a good way to deal with this in terms of, you know, for example, one suggestion is that why don't you put signs on places where these amoebas can be found? Well, they're hard to test for. And then the other concern is that what they don't want to have happen is they start labeling some lakes or areas where they say, hey, this is a possibility, and then give people a false sense of security when they go to another lake that just doesn't have a sign. And so they think, hey, it's okay, this one doesn't have a sign. So that's one thing that, you know, it's very difficult. So again, the prevailing method of avoiding this is to, one, keep your head dry if you can, if you're not going to go. But if you are going to go swimming, then wear a nose clip.
How about, remember those old, not the goggles they make from, you know, like Nike and everything, but remember the old masks we used to wear and scuba divers wear them?
Sure, of course.
That covers your nose. I bet you could do that.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
You could do that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. As long as, again, as long as there's only one way you can get infected with this, through your nose. And so if you protect your nose, whether that's with those clips or, you know, one of those old 1990s water goggles, then that works too.
Boy, I'm not going to look like Bo Derek walking out of the water. I'm going to look like the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yep.
Yeah, it may not be fashionable, but safe, right?
Right, much safer.
Well, thank you so much, Mark Remillard, ABC News correspondent. Stay safe out there, all right?
Thank you. You too.
Thanks, Mark. Take care. All right, a quick
break. It scares me.
It is scary. It really is, because you'd never think something, you know, in a nice fresh lake somewhere, you go, oh, I'm okay here, right? What's going to get me in there? And it's this. That's
awful.
There's
so much pigeon...
Yes.
Excretory stuff.
Yes.
And fish poop.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if that is causing this amoeba to continue, or if that kills it.
I don't know.
Because I'd be telling the kids to go ahead and let her rip in the pool.
Sure. That's good advice to the kids. Thanks, Wendy, for that. We'll take a quick break and then more show. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Hey, Cubs fans. Head to Jewel Osco every Sunday to collect your 2016 Chicago Cubs Fathead stickers. They're free inside the Chicago Tribune starting June 26th, which is now, through August 14th.
It already happened June 26th.
Yeah, so that should be corrected.
That was the past.
To say...
June 29th.
Yes. No, free inside today. The Chicago Tribune through August 14th.
Oh, yeah. Just say that. All right.
Can I tell you more about this brain-eating amoeba? Because I'm not kidding you when I say I'm scared.
You should. Anytime I hear the words brain eating, I get scared. I don't want anything eating my brain. Anything. Sometimes you'll just stare at me and you'll hold up a fork and I'm like, Wendy's going to eat my brain. This is going to be a bad day.
I'm not going to eat your brain. Before you go jump in the lake, this from the Oaklawn Patch, there could be a deadly organism lurking at the bottom of your favorite watering hole. Health experts are warning of a freshwater-dwelling organism. It's not a virus. It's an organism. Isn't this like a new series on TV, Brain Dead or something, where these little creatures from outer space come and get into your brain?
Yeah, I think that's the same. Well, not the same, but along the same vein, yeah.
Well, it's the brain-eating amoeba. It can be picked up in warm freshwater lakes, usually when swimmers get water up their nose, causing a burning sensation and sometimes sneezing. If you've ever swum before, if you ever
Listen
swam,
to you.
How many times have you gotten water up your nose and you feel the burning sensation?
Every time.
And then you sneeze because that's right. Your body's way of getting the water out of your nose.
It's happened every time ever when I've swum.
That's not even a word. But the danger isn't always over when the discomfort goes away. The brain-eating amoeba is believed to be responsible for the recent death of an 18-year-old Ohio teen after a whitewater rafting trip in North Carolina.
That's terrible.
The amoeba present in fresh water across the United States.
Can you remind me, are amoebas or amoeba, is that already plural? Amoeba? More than one amoeba? If you have more than one, well, let's just
swim.
Whether it's one amoeba or others similar to it, yeah, are they microscopic?
Yes,
they are. Right, they're really small,
yeah.
So you can't even notice them in the water. They're too small
That's
to
not
notice.
Like a shark or a guppy, even. This is under a microscope.
That's way too small.
They're microscopic little brain-eating amoebas.
Multamoeba.
Multamoebas.
Sounds like a cereal.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I had a bowl of
amoeba. What kind of a prize did you get in there? Brain-eating virus? Ew.
It's not funny.
No, it's not.
The amoeba present in freshwater across the United States causes primary amoebic meningoencephalitis. PAM for short. It sounds much better if you just
PAM.
Say PAM. A condition in which... Okay, this is a condition in which the covering of the brain and spinal cord swell due to the infection. The organism travels through the nose, up the nerve tissue, and into the brain. There, the organism is nourished by the brain. It eats your brain, eventually causing the destruction of the brain tissue.
See, I assumed that by the phrase brain-eating amoeba. I just knew that's what they were going for.
Symptoms of the infection appear 5 days after nasal exposure to the organism, and here's what they may include. Headache.
Yeah.
Nausea.
Yeah.
Vomiting.
Yeah.
And fever. Now, sometimes when you get a summer cold or you get sick in the summer after you've been to the beach, you might experience some of these
things.
Any
or all of those.
I know. Infection does not occur from drinking contaminated water, but from nasal ingestion only. Death occurs up to 18 days after symptoms begin.
Oh, man, is that fast.
According to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the U.S. faces between zero. Why do they even put that? Between zero and eight cases.
Well, you know, you assume there's at least one, or they wouldn't. It wouldn't be a thing if there wasn't at least one.
Yeah, so between zero. Say there have been eight cases reported of the parasitic
amoeba.
As many
as eight.
Right.
Yeah.
Every year, with 37 registered from 2006 to 2015. Although rare, most every case is fatal.
Mark Remillard said 97%. That's way too high.
The amoeba is found in warm to hot fresh water, including lakes, rivers, and hot springs. You know what? Oh, I guess chlorine in the hot tub.
Chlorine would kill it off.
I'm like, I'm not going in the hot tub anymore.
No, you're fine.
I don't even like it. It's too hot. It burns your butt.
Does it?
It's really hot.
You might want to position yourself away from the jets. Instead of just hogging the jets so nobody else can feel the bubbles.
You know, I know men typically don't wear a top on their bathing suit.
Well, unless it's the 1800s. Were you and Gentleman Jim swimming together? No, guys haven't worn tops to their swimsuits
so
in
you're
about
used
105
to it.
Years.
There's something with women about, like, you can get waist high in cold water, and then you can't make the commitment to expose the, you know, to put the girls underwater.
All right.
And I was wondering if guys had that same thing, because we even have protection over it, but
right.
You're just bare-chested.
Right.
It's... What, Kevin?
I don't want to say anything.
I think you should.
Somebody should.
But yes, guys have that, but yes.
So
but
it's hard to get in once, like, I can go into my waist, but then it's like, oh.
See, it's harder for us to get into the waist.
Right. Oh, okay. All right. Well, fine. Good
there's
enough.
There's a shock. There's a moment of shock.
You'll see guys go up on their tiptoes, and that's why.
Yeah.
Because we do the same thing. I mean... It's just, and getting in the hot tub's the same thing. It's like, I can't pull the trigger to go, I can go
right.
Just the bottom half, but then it's like, to go down in the hot tub, it's like, just a...
It's 10:30 once again, somewhere.
Tell us more, Wendy.
What does it feel like exactly?
Shut up! God, I can't even look at you anymore when I talk. I just can't. All right, be careful about the breathing.
You know, we had a reverend on the same show.
I don't,
an hour ago, there was a reverend on with us.
You're mean.
He's podcasting this.
Right.
You make me cry. It's just, I just was talking. Look what happens. I get in trouble just for talking.
Well, it's a talk show, so you're doing the right thing.
All right, shall we take a break?
Yeah.
Just be careful because... It's 97% of the time. It's fatal. The only foolproof way to keep from becoming infected is to avoid water-related activities in warm, fresh water. Happy summer.
You don't
want to
do that. It's this right. Exactly. That's terrible. All right. All right. I'm going to take a nap. We'll come back. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Boy, you're like a real DJ there, Bertrand.
Go on.
Bill, are you... I thought you were... pretending to play the keyboards.
No. I admire Steve for admitting that he was wrong. A lot of people in Steve's position would not have done it, but that's not our Steve Bertrand. He's the first to say.
I was actually wrong about many things, but that was the only one.
Well, while you were doing the news, I just want a cruise.
Yeah, somebody called you up and you want a cruise to the Bahamas. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Thank exciting? You very much.
That's very exciting.
And they said if I wanted to continue, I would say yes
right,
or no, and I was swearing.
You swore at them.
And they didn't know how to take that.
Right.
I guess you don't want to participate in our survey.
Right. Very true. Here's a story out of Canada that I find very interesting. It's there's a woman, Jennifer Engel, E-N-G-E-L-E. I'm guessing
that's... Engel?
Is it Engel? I wasn't sure if it was Angel or Engel, but let's go with Engel. Jennifer Engel. She has a boy. Sawyer is his name. He's 8 years old, and he has Down syndrome. He's in a class of 23 kids... one of the kids in the class is having a birthday party. They invited every kid in the class except for Sawyer, her son with Down syndrome. Every other kid who does not have Down syndrome was invited to a birthday party. Sawyer was excluded. And as you would imagine, she was a little bit taken aback by this. And she wrote a letter that she sent to the parents of the child who were having the birthday party to kind of express the fact that it's unfair.
You know, schools have started this thing, like if you're going to give out invitations in the classroom, you have to invite every single kid in the class or you can't do it. So that's why parents do things behind the scenes and mail them out, not going through school. Because I'm sorry, sometimes you can't have 27 kids.
See, that's what I was wondering is most classes, I think, are probably between 25 and 35 kids. So it's almost unrealistic.
Well, it depends. What age kid is this? What grade?
He's 8 years old, so I'm guessing that's probably third or fourth grade, right?
But then you could have it, you know, if it's in the summertime. Dylan's birthday was in the winter, and so I think, Michael, we did have a big party like that, and it was in the backyard because it was summer.
Right.
But, you know, if you're just, you know, as they get older, it's just maybe he's friends with three or four kids in school and then you just mail it on the sly. So you don't have to make, and you say, don't talk about it in class because we didn't invite all the boys.
That's the way to do it.
But if every single kid in the class but this one, that's terrible.
That's what makes it beyond suspect. You know, I think it's unrealistic to think that any kid almost anywhere would be friends with every single kid in their class, friends enough to want to invite them out on a birthday party. But in a case like this, where every single kid in the class was invited except her child.
See, that's terrible.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to hear this letter.
I'll read you the letter. Now, I'm going to say this. The letter is long and involved, and she gets her points across, I think, very, very well. I won't read you the whole letter, but I'll start it out, and feel free to stop me whenever. But this is from Jennifer, either Angle or Angel, from Canada. Again, her son Sawyer, 8 years old, the only one in the class who has Down syndrome, also the only one in the class not invited to a birthday party. Here's what Jennifer writes. Hi there. I know we don't know each other well, but my son Sawyer and your child are in the same class. I understand that your child recently delivered birthday invitations to the entire class.
All right, so it was done in school and everyone else. Yeah. Okay. Terrible.
The invitations to the entire class except to Sawyer, who was not invited. I also understand that this is not an oversight on your part, that it was an intentional decision to not include my son. I want you to know that we don't have an expectation of being invited to every birthday party. In fact, when Sawyer celebrated his birthday last year, we only invited a few close friends as we wanted to keep it small since it was over Christmas break. But in your case, this is not the same reason. In fact, you invited all 22 other children from the class except for my son. I know it's not because he's mean. You couldn't meet a happier child. I know it's not because he's not fun. He has a great sense of humor and an infectious laugh. I know it's not because your child and him don't get along. He's brought up your child's name to us on several occasions. The only reason why you decided it was okay to not invite my son to your child's birthday party is because he has Down syndrome. I'm sorry that you were not informed or maybe scared or uncertain about what it means to have Down syndrome. I know if you knew more about Down syndrome, you wouldn't have made this decision. I'm not mad at you. Rather, I think this is an opportunity for you to get to know my son better. You see, having Down syndrome doesn't mean that you don't want to have friends, and it doesn't mean that you don't have feelings, and it doesn't mean that you don't like to go to birthday parties. People with Down syndrome want the same things as you and I want. They want to have close relationships. They want to feel loved. They want to contribute. They want to have meaningful lives, and they want to go to birthday parties. It may be more difficult at times to understand my child, but the laughter and love that you share doesn't need interpretation. And then it goes on to say essentially what's already been said, but in different ways. It goes on quite a while. But is this parent, did she do the right thing?
You know, I was thinking about it as you were reading it because it's heartbreaking to me to hear this and to hear what she's feeling.
Yeah.
But it's an ugly world. And you know what? If someone has Down syndrome or not, there's going to be someone left out of something all the time. And I don't know. I don't know if she was writing it to just get this off her chest and make the parents feel guilty, then she's achieved the job. But I mean, you can't request that your kid be invited to something. You really can't. As I was listening.
That's so tough. I don't know if I was in this exact same situation, how I would handle it. I think I'd be inclined to just take my son aside and say, this is unbelievably unfair. And unfortunately, it's somebody who doesn't understand, as she wrote, doesn't understand the complications of this, and that's so unfortunate, and it's not a reflection on you. Please don't think it is. But then if you're the kid, you think to yourself, I'm trying not to be different, but I am obviously different because I've not been invited to this party that every other kid is invited to. I don't know how you win in a situation like this.
Well, I like your idea of telling the kid, you know, this has nothing to do with you.
Right.
You know, the world's not a very fair place. Hey, you want to go see the SpongeBob musical this weekend?
Find something else.
Really?
Find the time.
That's what I would do.
You know, it was always tough. I don't know if you've gone through this with your boys. I remember going through this myself when I was a kid, when my parents would say, we're having a birthday party, and then there's a cutoff.
Yeah.
You go, you know, do you want to have 10 friends? Pick 10 friends. And then invariably, there's one or two or three or four kids that you go, boy, if my limit's 10, how do I invite him and not her and her and not him? It's almost impossible.
It is really hard, but that's, I mean, and unfortunately, you can't afford to have the whole class.
Right.
Because I couldn't wait for the kids to get older because they'd pick like two or three friends that they wanted to have over.
Yeah.
We'd take them, or they'd come over and watch a movie and order a pizza or something.
Right.
And then they could walk and get ice cream. That was manageable. Then you'd do a little sleepover. It was perfect.
That's good. That's
I loved
good thing.
The day when the huge party went away.
Right.
Loved it.
But this is different in that every other kid in the class was invited except for this kid. So that compounds it.
I am heartbroken for the whole situation, but honestly, as I was listening to what the mother was writing, it's like, you know, if she's trying to educate them and explain, you know, this could happen.
Right.
They could come to the party, but it's like, you can't do anything about it. People,
right.
You can't change people's decisions, can you? Hey, Patrick.
Yes, you can't change opinions. You're assuming that everybody in the world understands what Down syndrome is. And a lot of people don't. A lot of people are ignorant of so many of the mental illnesses that are out there that all they have to hear is mental. And they think, you know, the worst case scenario.
Well, they have very closed minds about it unless it affects, and if it affects you, then you know about it. But don't you think enough people know about Down syndrome these days?
Bill is totally right. There's how many kids and only the one kid doesn't get invited? That's ignorant. That's a parent that doesn't know what Down syndrome is, doesn't want to have to deal with a kid that they don't know what's going to happen when the kid comes to the party. If we get them overexcited, is he going to drop and, you know, have some kind of attack? They don't know. Not everybody knows what Down syndrome is. And it's just like every other, you know, autism or whatever, you know, people hear autism, they think automatically, boom, this person's just, you know, they're not normal. And that's, no, they're not normal, but they're, you know, every autism case is completely different than the next. You know, some people have autism, you can't tell. Some people have autism, you can tell right off the bat.
I'd be more scared, honestly, as a host of a party, I'd be more scared having a kid with a food allergy at my house because I really would be scared to...
You're knowledgeable to the situation. So, you know, again, big cities, we have all the allergy, you know, accidents.
EpiPens.
And we have kids that have Down syndrome, and it's not such a, you know, yeah. Even in the city, I guarantee you, if you went down the street right now and asked 50 people what Down syndrome was, they wouldn't really have an idea.
I bet all 50 unless would know. I'm sorry, at least 49.
No way. Again, giving way too much credit to the average person. Common sense is not so common, okay? It's plain and simple. I guarantee you these people had no clue and didn't want to deal with it. Like Bill said, you can't invite 22 kids and be like, oh, we can't afford that last 23rd kid.
Yeah, I would love to hear their excuse. I'd love to hear the other parents' excuse as to why they're in it.
Let's try and get the parent on. What do you think about the mom writing the letter explaining it, Patrick?
Again, I think it's, you know, it's fair. You know, she's venting out, and again, she's not yelling at the people at all. She's plain and simple saying, hey, you know, maybe you should meet my son so you can see that Down syndrome is not contagious. You know, maybe you never know what people think.
Yeah, that's true. Patrick, thank you so much for your call. Bill, we were mentioning something about a rule that was going on. If you're passing out invitations in the classroom, it should include everyone.
Right.
Or you have to do it outside of school. Beth, you're a teacher. Is that true?
Well, yeah, I think that we all know, at least I noticed that this was, you know, a school in Canada. So we have to take that into consideration because we don't know what their rules and regulations are. But generally speaking, I mean, teachers just know better. I mean, I don't want to be mean about it, but shame on that teacher that she allowed that to happen. I mean, we're supposed to be creating classrooms that include all students and that, you know, are inclusive of all students and their, you know, strengths and their weaknesses. I mean, I just have to ask myself, where was the teacher when this little boy was passing out only 22 instead of 23 invitations?
That is a great
21?
Point.
I was wondering that myself, Beth. You're a teacher, so you'd know this better than me. If you saw a kid handing out that many invitations, wouldn't you just naturally assume he or she is handing one out to everybody? I would assume that.
Well, for sure. I mean, I guess you would assume that. I mean, every teacher has their classroom day structured in different ways, and there are certain time periods for certain things at the elementary school level. And, you know, I don't know, maybe there's time enough for kids to get up and mill around, or they were taking a break, or they were finished with a particular part of the lesson. I mean, I really can't imagine, you know, some kid just standing up in an elementary classroom and just starting to pass out, you know, that number of invitations without a teacher, like, taking notice.
Yep.
But maybe she thought everyone got one, you know, like she didn't see this kid walk over to the desk of the student and thought, oh, well, everybody's obviously getting an invitation.
Yeah, and that's a point well taken. I don't disagree with that because as a teacher, I understand that you can't know everything and see everything 100% of the time. So I do agree with that.
Beth, we appreciate the call. Thanks so much. Have a good summer.
I love your show, you guys.
Oh, you're very nice.
Thanks.
Thank
Maybe
you.
Maybe the teacher should pass it out. Maybe that would help.
That's interesting. Let's do this. We'll take a break, and we've got a bunch more people on the line. Mary, stay there. I'm anxious to hear from Mary especially, but all the calls, 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
All right, there's a little kid in third or fourth grade who's having a birthday party. Goes to class, gives invitations to everyone but one child, and that child has Down syndrome.
Not fair.
It is so not fair, and Mary would like to talk to us. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just wanted to offer some how I feel about this. My son has Asperger's autism, and he's on the spectrum, and you can tell. And he is different than the other kids. And I know that there were many parties that we were not invited to, but it was definitely more of an issue for me than for him. He's a happy, loving, he's not able to understand things in a way that he wasn't invited or he left out.
So he didn't feel left out because he didn't quite know necessarily that he was left out of a big party.
Exactly, and I understand the hurt feelings, but that's really life.
Mary, have you ever confronted, like, when you knew these parties went on and your son was not involved, had you ever confronted or thought about confronting a parent saying, everyone but my kid, no?
No. We'd be doing it all the time, you know. Everybody wants to act like they're so concerned about your situation and understanding, and then they go home and they tuck in their neurotypical kids, and it's just the pity thing for you that you're, you know, it's, I don't, who wants to be invited to that person's house?
I guess you're right on that, Mary.
That's awful. So awful.
You know what? So this woman did write a letter just kind of saying, you know, my son loves to laugh. He's a lot of fun. A texter just sent something in that I think is a great idea. I think that as long as this woman was writing the letter, she might have suggested that if her son were to be invited, she would also go to help with the party to meet the mom and help everyone get over their fears. But still, you can't write to somebody and go, you know, my son wasn't invited to this party. Shame on you. You can't really do that because people can do what they want.
No. And it's fine at school. Actually, you know, the kids are more accepting of the kid probably than his parents understand. It was the parents' issue, not the kids' issue.
Well, Wendy and I were trying to figure out by this letter if it was the child who made the determination that every kid in the party, every kid in the class should be invited to the party, or right. if it was the parents. It's hard for us
but
to determine.
But then the parent says it's all or none. That's the rule. And someone else has texted, I think that schools should adopt a new policy stating that all birthday party invitations must be given to the teacher to pass out.
Oh, that's interesting.
Or you do it in the mail on your own, yeah. and, you know, that happens. Because sometimes you can't invite the whole class.
Right.
I think that should be separate of the school. I mean, it's your personal kids' party.
That's
Why
true.
Why would you put that in the mix of everybody else?
You're absolutely right. It's something that's happening outside of school time. So mail the invitations or drop them off at somebody's house.
But that right. said, think about it. Even if it does go through an outside source, let's say it was done online, you know, they have all those party invitation
oh, the Evites.
Services.
Yeah.
So if
yeah.
you're the kid or the parent of the child and you determine, even though it was out of school, that everybody in the class has been invited except your son, it still is going to hurt just as much,
How
isn't
do you know,
it?
Though?
Word travels, yeah. you know.
Mary, so sorry, and you're a good mom.
We aren't sorry. We are blessed. We adopted him knowing that he had issues, and I'm grateful to be his mom.
I just meant I'm sorry you were treated that way. Not that I'm sorry about your son.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mary.
That is a good mom.
Yep. No doubt about it. Thanks, everybody, for chiming in on this.
Oh, we're out of showtime.
We're out of showtime. We're out of show. But we do
appreciate
the calls. I'm not
inviting you to the show tomorrow.
I'm used to that. I'm more than used to that. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll find out what Ro and Anna have next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.